award-winning Night Call, the Riff's Phone-In Talk Show on 101 WRIF Detroit. Our number, 313-298-WRIF. Now, here's the host of Night Call, Peter Werby.
Thank you very much. Welcome, everybody. A pleasure to be with you as usual. And if you're a longtime listener, you know the number, 313-298-WRIF. That's particularly good, although you're welcome to call from anywhere. That's particularly good, though, from our main broadcasting area, southeastern Michigan, northern Ohio, and southeastern Ontario. But via the internet, we are all over the world, all over the country. So, welcome to all of you. Thanks for being with me. And if you're just new, this is a talk show, and we talk about the issues of the day. And we're generally pretty decent. You know, some people have been emailing me and said, I'm not as decent as I used to be. People say, you're not as polite. You're not as tolerant as you used to be. Well, the stuff is getting too deep. And so it does give me a little bit of an attitude. And I said last week that the word of the week was favanculo, right? Favanculo. Favanculo. That's what the Supreme Court Justice Antonin Scalia said in church, which essentially means F you. Right. That's how he said he was going to deal with his critics. Here's a man, supposedly a respected jurist. Actually, he's a right-wing fanatic. I mean, really far out right-wing. And I thought, well, if that's the way he's going to deal with his critics, hey, that's the way I'm going to deal with mine. And I don't mean people that disagree with me, because people have honest disagreements. But dyed-in-the-wool, ideological right-wingers, hey, favanculo. That's what I say. And that's probably what I'll say to you if you call. You'll say something, and I'll say, favanculo. But actually, you're saying, wait a minute, have I heard this program before? I was saying the same thing at the beginning of last Sunday's show, so I don't want to get too deep into that. But I was thinking, so that could be the word. Maybe we could have like a word a week. So last week's word was, favanculo, but it's going to be ITMFA. ITMFA. Now, I can't really say what that stands for on the air. It's kind of got a little bit of relationship to what Scalia told his critics. But you can go to my website and see what it says. It's Peter Werby, W-E-R-B-E, W-E-R-B-E, peterwerby.com. And you can see what ITMFA means. And we'll kind of talk about what's the basis of ITMFA a little later in the broadcast. All right, 313-298-WRIF. If you want to email me, keep them short, or I can't, you know, if they're long, I read them, but not on the air, because I look and I say, whoo, this is too much. So keep them short, and I'll read some of them on the air. calltalkyes@yahoo.com. calltalkyes@yahoo.com. Enormous demonstration in Dallas today. The police say 350,000 to half a million. And you can imagine what the participants say, what the organizers say. It's been my experience that generally the people organizing things are usually spot on about how many people are there. But even so, half a million people marching, probably 200 cities. Tomorrow we'll be having immigrant rights marches, and also some of the places will be tantamount to a general strike. Now, I was listening, as I sometimes do, to a right-wing talk show coming in here. I mean, I always feel a little dirty after listening to these guys. They're so mean-spirited. They're such awful human beings, and their stock in trade is to rile you. Now, most of you aren't susceptible to that. And you understand hate speech and intolerance and people trying to pull your chain in order to get big ratings. But when you have them, you're on, say, on your 600 stations, even though those stations don't get particularly good ratings, when you add them all up, there's a lot of people. Because there's a lot of angry, mean-spirited, intolerant people in this country. There really are. And mostly people keep it to themselves. But what these right-wing talk show hosts do is they give people social permission to express their anger and their intolerance and prejudices and all of that. And I understand, doesn't mean I approve of it in any ways, I understand where a lot of the anger comes from. But it's usually misdirected. It's usually in this case, you're starting to see, you get these internet messages and you hear these talk show hosts, these awful Mexicans, they're ruining our country, they're stealing our jobs, they're destroying the economy. Because of them, we're losing in Iraq. I mean, they haven't said that yet, but that's next. But please remember, well, here, let me just get you a little taste of something. Americans say immigration a rising concern. And this is from the Associated Press. People are now about as likely to mention immigration as the economy when they're asked to name the most important problem facing the United States, though both rank behind war in Iraq and elsewhere. Well, that's good, at least. But this is like everything else. You skip to the loo, you jump, you respond, you come to the master's call whenever he says the word. You don't know what I'm saying? Remember I said last week about don't get fooled again. And I'm not trying to say that immigration is not a problem. There's things in many, many things in this country that should be addressed. And the whole problem of an economy that's attractive to people, in some cases just miles away. There's an artificial line in the sand there. One side they're paying $24 an hour for auto workers. The other side they're paying $2.40. That's a problem. NAFTA, the North American Free Trade Agreement, is a terrible problem that created a lot of this. The border policy policing, which I'll get to in a little while, is a problem, the cause of all of this. So it's complex. Also, we are in a period where there's great economic insecurity. And that very frequently, that anxiety that all of us have. How many of you out there know that you're going to have a job for in the next couple of years? Are absolutely 100% sure you're going to stay in the job that you're busting your butt doing every day? Whether it's in an office or whether it's in a shop, whether it's in the streets, wherever it is, factory. Who out here really thinks that their job is secure enough that they're going to make it right on through in terms of the plans you have? Either stay in it as long as you choose, or stay in it for a lifetime the way our parents and grandparents could, and retire with a good pension that covers us into old age, that we're secure then. I don't see a lot of hands going up. My job's pretty secure, and I'm not raising my hand, because you never can tell. All right, so that really creates a basis for anxiety. And what people frequently do, not the smart people, but the people that either can't figure it out or are afraid of the consequences of figuring it out, is they look for scapegoats. And that's been done all over the world. In some Asian countries, people attack the Chinese because they're the result of, they're the problem that have caused the problems in the economy of Indonesia, for instance, or someplace like that. In Germany, it was the Jews. Here now, it's some people, fortunately, it's not the majority, it's the Mexican illegal immigrants. Other Latin American immigrants. But let me say this. We have talked before in terms of the Iraq war that this is nothing when I say I told you so. This is nothing like you say I told you so or anything like that. But I told you, many of the callers told you, that this war was based on lies, that there were no weapons of mass destruction, that Saddam Hussein was not involved in 9/11. And you go, oh, no, I saw it on television. I saw Colin Powell. I saw George Bush. I saw Donald Rumsfeld. I saw Dick Cheney. Right? So why not believe all these rich guys in suits that got flags in their lapels and they're on television? They got 19 flags behind them. Why wouldn't you believe them over me? Why wouldn't you believe them over all the callers on Night Call? Well, you got fooled. They screwed you. Now there's tens of thousands of dead Iraqis, probably over 100,000. There's thousands of Americans dead. There's a minimum of 15,000 Americans with grievous wounds that they'll carry with them for the rest of their lives. We told you that, but you believed these people who you should never believe. When they speak, make the assumption they're lying. Make the assumption they're trying to manipulate you. Make the assumption that they do not have your best interests in mind. They have only their own narrow interests in mind. Both their ruling class interests, they're the wealthy. They're the ultra wealthy. So when they create policy, it's for them. It's not for you. It's not for me. It's for them only. But they need you. They have to convince you. There's still these ostensible democratic forms that they have to get approval through. Now I don't even know if they care about that. They've got other ways. They've got other things in mind. And well, so go back to like June 2002. Whoa, man. Dude, this is not a history class. Well, it's not so long ago. You know, stuff happened in the 90s as well that inform what's going on today. But if you go back to 2002, Bush's poll numbers were very low, and that's when they played the Iraq card. I've talked to you about this any number of times before. That's when Bush decided, probably as a result of Karl Rove, the Machiavellian Rasputin behind Bush, that this was the time to play the Iraq card because they could both carry out what would be carried out would be both the long range strategy of occupying Iraq. This was planned for years and years ahead, and also would boost Bush's poll numbers so that the Republicans would win in November of 2002. Well, it all came off. So people like me, I'm shouting and screaming, it's a lie, they don't have it, I know they don't. And I didn't guess. I wasn't over there. I don't have secret sources. All the information was there. And that's how I knew. And that's how millions of people around the world knew that as well, right? Okay, so I'm saying learn your lesson. I'm not lecturing the majority of you, but I am lecturing, and I know it's not always pleasant, so, take it for what it's worth, that when you hear these same politicians, let alone any politician, I should say it the other way around, let alone the same politicians that have a history of lying, have a history of manipulating the American people, that when they say something, be suspicious, be real suspicious. Why all of a sudden now do Americans say immigration a rising concern? Why didn't they say that 3 months ago? Well, all of a sudden, Bush discovered that immigration was a real problem. And now, because of this bill that was put into Congress that would, it was a terrible insult to people and didn't deal with the problem, would make criminals of millions and millions of people. When you had Republicans talking about rounding up everybody and putting them in camps and making them forced labor to build a wall, well, gee, doesn't that kind of piss people off? I guess it does. So when I hear, go back, see if you can read or go back and listen to some of these recordings of segregationists or just conservatives, because you got to remember, the conservatives supported segregation, just like the conservatives supported slavery. The conservatives supported everything bad in American history, have never created or provided any step forward to make this country more democratic, have always been at the forefront of making America less and less democratic. The conservatives are the one that wanted to restrict the vote at near the founding of our country to white propertied men. That's who they thought. White men with property. That was it. It's been a struggle ever since to expand democracy. Now we're going the other way. We're back to elite government, minority rule for the ultra wealthy. So watch this stuff. Don't send stupid emails with racist jokes around. Don't get indignant over the fact that there are people from another country in our country illegally. Not saying it's not a problem. It's not saying that something should be addressed. Don't get indignant, and don't call up the show and be indignant when the United States is involved in this catastrophic war, spending hundreds of billions of dollars that rightfully should have been ours because we paid that, that goes to the companies that make the war and the companies that are rebuilding Iraq with our dollars and stealing most of it. That's what you should be indignant about. So let's watch this. Let's sit back and see what is a result. These huge marches that are taking place are our fellow human beings. Lots of them are our fellow citizens. In fact, the majority of people involved in this are our fellow citizens. These are immigrants, people that are here legally, people that have become citizens. But ultimately, they're fellow human beings that want the same thing out of life that you and I do. And the fact that we're all facing economic security, and even at the lower rungs, maybe there is a direct result from the economic insecurity the working poor feel the pressure of immigrant labor. Let's not have this battle at the bottom. Because you know who always makes out? the rich guys at the top. All right, I was going to read this whole thing, but it's way too long. It was in the New York Times the other day, and it's by a professor that's at Princeton, Douglas Massey, and he's studied immigration patterns. Well, gee, guess what? The immigration patterns are no different than they were 20 years ago. Same percentage for our population to the entry of illegal immigrants is the same, absolutely the same. You know what's different and what caused it all? Mostly, according to his studies, the vast majority of undocumented Mexicans entered through either El Paso or San Diego. El Paso has around 700,000 residents. I'm reading some of it. And is 78% Hispanic, whereas San Diego County has 3 million residents, 27% Hispanic. So that's where the hundreds of thousands of illegals would come in. And, you know, a lot of people involved in immigrant rights don't like that phrase, illegal. They say, no human is illegal. Well, it's illegal under the statutes of the United States. So I don't find any problem with that. Well, this changed in 1992. The Border Patrol built a steel fence south of San Diego and created and stopped the flow into San Diego. People in San Diego, I don't know whether they demanded or what, but that was the stop. They also stopped people coming into El Paso. So you know what? You know what happened then? That was the cause of why people are coming in through the desert. So that upped the death rate considerably and began to flood these small rural towns and ranches and what have you with illegal immigrants, with these coyotes that bring them across, and created a great amount of the problem. Now, let's see. In 1989, two-thirds of undocumented migrants came in through El Paso or San Diego. By 2004, two-thirds crossed somewhere else. So essentially all that was done by heavier enforcement was to deflect where people arrived in the United States from Mexico and Central America. Now, also, since the borders have become so secure where they could, it created a fence that kept people in. Because according to Professor Massey's study, that during the 1980s, the probability that an undocumented migrant would be apprehended while crossing stood at about 33%. Oh, this is another fact. By 2000, it was 10%. So the amount of people that would be apprehended has gone way down, even though the budget has gone from $200 million to $1.6 billion. So there's more money being spent. It's this heavily fortified border. And it said, although border militarization has had little effect on the probability of Mexicans migrating illegally, it did reduce the likelihood that they would return to their homeland. So the heavy enforcement meant that people that came here were more likely to stay. America's tougher line roughly tripled the average cost of getting across the border illegally. Thus, Mexicans who had run the gauntlet at the border were more likely to hunker down and stay in the United States. My study has shown that in the early 1980s, about half of all undocumented Mexicans returned home within 12 months of entry. By 2000, the rate of return migration stood at just 25%. So that's not working either. And people that say, let's round up everybody. We talked about that. All right, 313-298-WRIF, Peter Werbe here with you. According to Seymour Hersh, the United States, Bush is thinking about attacking Iran with nuclear weapons. These people are mad, absolutely out of their minds. We are being ruled by incompetent lunatics. I don't know if you can have competent lunatics, but We don't have those. Bush administration, according to Hersh, while publicly advocating diplomacy in order to stop Iran from pursuing a nuclear weapon, has increased clandestine activities inside Iran and intensified planning for a possible major air attack. Current and former American military and intelligence officials said that Air Force planning groups are drawing up lists of targets, and teams of American combat troops have been ordered into Iran undercover to collect targeting data and to establish contact with anti-government ethnic minority groups. The officials say that President Bush is determined to deny the Iranian regime the opportunity to begin a pilot program planned for this spring to enrich uranium. Now, a couple of people say, wow, man, I don't want them. to have nukes. Well, I don't want anyone to have nukes. I don't want Israel in that area to have them. I don't want Russia to have them. Pakistan, I mean, Pakistan could be the most dangerous country in the world that has nukes, and you know, it's run by our buddy, this military dictatorship. And Bush just went to India, this rogue state that won't even sign the non-proliferation treaty and has an illegal nuclear program. Say, yeah, it's okay. That's cool. But right now, the White House sought to dampen the idea of a military strike in Iran, saying that they're conducting normal defense and intelligence planning. Britain's foreign secretary called the idea of a nuclear strike completely nuts. Whoa, that's scary, because these people are completely nuts. Now, let's see. Let me just look here. Yeah. United States can't deal with this irregular insurgency. This irregular insurgency in Iraq. How are they going to deal? I mean, maybe they're just going to do these airstrikes. But, Iran has just tested all these missiles. And you know what's right next to Iraq? Yeah, Iran. And, you know, all the Shiites, all of our buddies that we put in office, they're all allied with Iran. That's their buddies. They're Shiites in Iran. They're Shiites in Iraq. And if the United States attacks Iran, all hell is going to break loose all over the world, including possibly here. So you say, well, how could Bush be that stupid? Well, I did say they're incompetent, but they're also mad. And they rule best during chaos. They rule best during chaos. You and I want a peaceful life. We want security. We want a regularity of response economically, certainly in terms of security, everything. We don't want to be in constant conflict. But that's where these guys shine. At least they think they do. I mean, they couldn't pour poop out of a boot if the instructions were on the heel, to paraphrase Lyndon Johnson. But what I think they're counting on, and if they do this, if they're really as crazy as I think they are, if they actually strike Iran, and all hell breaks loose. If there's terrorist attacks here, Hezbollah starts with attacks in Israel. If there is this major insurgency increased in Iraq, well, probably they see this will do well for them in the elections this November. Could they be this crass and that crazy? I think so. You tell me what you think, though. Peter Werby here with you on the Night Call Show. And this does lead back to the ITMFA. ITMFA, you can go to my website and figure out what that's all about. PeterWerby.com, PeterWerby.com. And, man, you guys are really, let me see, is it all guys? Yeah. Some women can call. I know we usually don't have them, but women are welcome to call. I just wonder, too, Iran test fires these top-secret missiles that are that could be fired from all military helicopters and jet fighters. I mean, Iraq had an army of dust. They had no army. They threatened nobody. This was another big lie. They were destabilizing the region. They didn't have they couldn't have even invaded Kuwait again. They didn't have the capacity to do it. But now they got these missiles. What do they do? Maybe they start shooting at U.S. bases in Iraq. So, well, what do we do? I mean, people say, Iran, they're crazy. Well, you know what? They think we're crazy. And maybe they're all crazy. Maybe they're all mad. Well, maybe we as a people, the world's people, ought to start demanding that we have a world based on sanity rather than absolute insanity. Well, we can't do that. I'm just here listening to the radio. I just watch television every night. What can I do? Well, maybe we're just screwed then, huh? Unless we start doing something. Unless we start combining as the people, free from these rulers that have no interest other than their own insane agendas. All right. Oh, man, there's so many other things to talk about, but let me see what you've got to say. 313-298-WRIF. Here's Brian in Gibraltar. Brian, hi. It's Peter Werby. You're on the air. Welcome.
Hey, Peter. How you doing?
Doing great, thanks.
I hate to shift gears a little bit more on like some domestic stuff.
No, good, great.
Over Middle East. The one thing that bothers me the most, you know, and I think I'm a perfect example of this. I'm 26. I'm a college graduate, and the job economy here in Michigan is so terrible that I decided to go back to college, because I was more specialized towards sales. And now I'm going back for an engineering degree in construction management just so I can get out of this state and go kind of ride the construction wave and the boom from the south. But, you know, and that's one thing that bothers me. And, you know, there's all this talk about we got to raise the test scores for our kids. And, you know, our children, they're not showing up, you know, with the rest of the world and how they're doing. And then they go and they do this legislation that just cuts higher education.
Yeah, that's
just
amazing.
Take all this money. Let's cut out higher education. And now my ability, because, you know, and I took a $30,000 a year pay cut, yikes, take a part-time job working at an auto parts store just so I could go back to college. And now they're going to cut my financial aid, cause, and I need that.
This is in the Bush budget you're talking about. Yeah.
What are you doing? It's almost like a two-faced thing. Hey, we got to have smarter kids, but don't think about going to college. Forget about that.
Well, we can.
You got to get smarter, though.
Well, for one thing, we can always talk about whatever you want to talk about. So there's no problem about talking about it. And this is very important because it's very direct, it's very local, it's very personal. But many people are in the same spot you are. But I can bring it right back to the Middle East, and that is that this war could cost up to $1 trillion. $1 trillion already cost $300 billion, and one of the things we could do we could have free higher education. Why don't we have free college for our citizens?
Yeah, but and then also my next point on that is, okay, so say we do have these college grads going, but now we're shipping so many jobs overseas, a lot of high tech jobs, and that's not just the jobs, we're shipping a lot of high tech stuff over now too. You're gonna have this surplus of people. You're gonna have your manual worker and you're gonna have your educated worker.
I don't know where it is all gonna shake out. It's gotta be somebody smarter than me to figure that one. All right, Brian, I appreciate you bringing that up. I think a lot of other people, as I said, are in the same boat and have the same qualms. All right, thanks. Here's David in Detroit. Hi, David. It's Peter Werby.
Hi. Yeah. Carrying on what Brian was saying about education, I'm calling to celebrate another victory in favor of the evolutionists over the monkey-brained creationists who dumbed down the schools by promoting the biblical intelligent design mythology instead of teaching science.
Where was this? What are you talking about?
Well, researchers published in the journal Nature this past week that they discovered fossil evidence in the Canadian Arctic from 375 million years ago, which shows the macroevolution of fish that had scale-covered arms instead of fins. Fish with arms that could move on dry land and had a skeletal structure that could support both gills and lungs.
David, can I tell you something?
Yeah.
When God created the world 4,000 years ago, he created that fossil, too.
Well, there you go.
That's what they say.
That's what they say. Well, yeah, it shows that how fish evolved into land-dwelling animals and shows that the intelligent design is just a bunch of supernatural BS. And I'll tell you what, that George, it's no more an exaggeration now for you to say that George W. Bush comes from a family pedigree of scaly crocodilian sharks.
Well, we all did, though.
That's true, but there you go.
Well, here's another problem for the religious. They're always talking about praying for people. They just there was this American Heart Journal that did this large study that said praying for sick people has absolutely no effect on their health. In fact, it found that patients who had undergone heart surgery and knew that people were praying for their recovery had more health complications as a result. That 59% of patients having complications after surgery, the highest group, were patients that knew they were receiving prayers. And it says, does this mean knowing people are praying for you is bad for your health? Some say that the stress of thinking, I must be really ill if people are praying for my health, may have contributed towards the health complications. So if you hear me getting sick, folks, don't pray for me. All right, thank you. And thank you, David. I appreciate your call. 313-298-WRIF. Here's Jim in Canton. Jim, hi. It's Peter Werby. You're on the air on WRIF.
How you doing, man?
Doing good.
Yeah, I agree with most of what you're thinking. But, you know, when it comes to what happened in Iraq, you know, both parties agreed to that.
Well, both didn't. Fortunately, our two senators voted against the war resolution, and all but one of the The Democrats in this country, in this state voted against it as well. Yeah, I mean, listen, there are a bunch of opportunists. John Kerry, Hillary Clinton, John Edwards, they knew there were no weapons of mass destruction, and yet they voted for this because they don't have the courage of their convictions. Now you got Kerry's saying we got to have a deadline of May for them to create a government, and we have to have all troops out by December 31st. Where the hell was he with that when he was running for president?
Yeah, you got that right.
Yeah.
Anyways, I'm an old rocker from Detroit. I'm probably your age.
Well, rock on, my man. Keep on rocking. All right, thanks a lot. Do I got a next up here? No, so I will just go to the person who's been on the longest. It's Eric from Romeo.
Hey, how you doing tonight?
Good. What's up?
I was just calling. You were talking about how Americans were profiting from a bunch of these contracts in Iraq, and I think it's completely egregious. And I was curious if you knew which president allowed executives of Enron to not only sleep in the White House, spend weekends there, but also donate to his campaign reelection fund.
Tell me it was Clinton.
That would be Clinton.
Yeah. Well, there is a continuity of being in bed with these corporate contributors. I mean, that's what enough people have said is one of the problems with the way the system is run is if you want to be elected, even to smaller offices, you've got to solicit these funds. And of course, what's the old saying? He who pays the piper, calls the tune, right? And I mean, think about the Telecommunications Act of 1996 that Clinton sold and sold out, really. I'm no big Clinton fan, so.
Okay, well, I just want to, it was one of your Democrat friends, so, on every single Republican out there.
Well, yeah, but I haven't seen any Democrats running anything in a long time. And if you want to say that, that Bush is as bad as Clinton or Clinton is as bad as Bush in some regards, I wouldn't give you any argument, but it's an odd argument for someone who's one of the few people left in the country that still supports Bush, but go for it. All right, thanks. Let's do this. Let's just take a brief break. Not many spots tonight, so hey, it's more time to talk. That's good. 313-298-WRIF. We'll be right back.
You're listening to WRIF.com.
Everything, look at I have a track record, as do a lot of people that have my beliefs, of being correct. What we say about Bush Co., Bush Incorporated, Bush and Sons Incorporated. So that would make me think, if I was you, Ben, that when these guys speak, I would make the assumption they're lying and then find out if not. I think I've got a pretty good record, but should you believe it, what I say at face value? No, of course not. I make statements and you go, whoa, I've never thought that or heard that, or I don't know if that's true. Look it up. Look it up. This is just my opinion. But people are willing to go to war on the lies of George W. Bush and the rest of his criminal gang, right? So, anyway, here's about criminals as well. Tony in Canton, he's mad, boy. He's writing capital letters. That's like shouting at you, right? That's bad netiquette. Illegal immigrants are breaking the law. Gee, really? People who break the law are criminals. Criminals' blood, sweat, and tears are tainted, you see? These people do not add to our economy, for they are criminals. Peter, you are weak and paranoid. I would debate you any day and win. Tony, I don't think so. But I don't want to macho on you. But read a little more. And like I said, wait and see how this shakes out. Oh, yeah, right. I was urging people to go to my website, Peter Werbe, W-E-R-B-E, peterwerbe.com, to go for tonight's word or phrase, I-T-M-F-A, I-T-M-F-A. Eric in Ypsilanti says 75% of the populace, give or take, disagreed with the impeachment of Clinton when it took place. That was for the right reason. Bush has now fully admitted that the reasons we marched the war were not valid, meaning it could not be more obvious we were lied to by Bush Co. ITMFA all the way. You have to go to the site to find out what that's all about. Okay, let's see here. Let's go back to our phones and searching around here for the one I'm looking for. Okay, here is David in East Point. David, hi, it's Peter Werbe. You're on the air.
How you doing, Peter? I wanted to talk to you. It was about, you mentioned us going into Iran, and to me it's like, it's similar to like after World War One, what happened with Germany, where, you know, there was the war, and then because of Germany, it was like wrong what they did, and they came up with the chemical weapon, so we kind of suppressed them, and we were afraid, and then it was like what started World War Two. So it's like it's the same thing, the fear, and it's like it destroys, you know, it's like. And that was the point I wanted to make. And I see it in a lot of other areas. And so, like, for safety, like, taking away people's guns, stuff along that lines, and just seems to, nothing good comes from it. It just makes things worse.
All right. Thank you. Thank you for your opinion. Appreciate that. Here's Will in Ontario. Will, thanks for making our show international. You're on the air.
Oh, thanks, Peter. Thanks for taking my call. 2 points. First of all, I just wanted to correct one thing. On your show last week, it was driving me crazy. I couldn't get to a phone, but you know how you were trying to pronounce an Italian profanity that came out of Scalito's mouth? It's mafangu.
That's something, no, I'm telling you, it's vaffanculo.
Yeah, no, it's mafangu, mafangu. That's how you pronounce it.
Mafangu?
Yeah, no, it's mafangu.
Where's the ma? It's V-A... F-A-N-C-U-L-O.
Yeah, that's a prefix. It's a prefix that you use when you use that form of profanity.
I don't know. I got a lot of Italians. Wait, where's your background?
No.
Where in Italy do your people come from?
I'm nowhere. I'm a Ukrainian German, but I grew up in an Italian neighborhood in Windsor, Ontario, and all my band members, they're all Italian, so I learned all the Italian profanity growing up.
So you're saying it's spelled correctly, but I'm just mispronouncing it.
Yeah, it's a fangu.
Well, I've heard of fangu before, but I always thought that was kind of just butchered Italian coming close to what we say. Let's not come any closer either.
That's the only.
I don't know. A lot of Sicilians and Italians say it is favanculo. I was saying favanculo, but it's favanculo.
Yeah, you're
All right.
Sorry, it was just driving me crazy. I just had...
All right. We'll get some more very cunning linguist in on this. All right.
That's it.
Yeah.
Just one quick point. I was reading a book called America Alone by Roy Halpert. Really good. He's actually a Republican writing about American foreign policy. And regarding the Iran situation, he was quoting a meeting held by Donald Rumsfeld with some of his staffers back in 2003 when the American Armed Forces first started getting bogged down in Iraq. And he made some comment to the effect that if we get bogged down, the thing is to escalate the situation so that if we can't find an acceptable solution to get out with an acceptable solution, we escalate it because we have the power to do so, sort of mix it up and hope that we can come up with a better exit by doing that.
Now, hey, let me ask you a question as you're calling from Canada, Will.
Mm-hmm.
Stephen Harper, this new Bush
right.
clone, this
right.
Right-wing prime minister, he says he's not possession of small amounts of marijuana was going to be decriminalized, and he's announced that it's going to remain a crime.
That's right. Our last prime minister, Chrétien, was actually put through Parliament a decriminalization statute that you could carry up to 20 grams of marijuana, and... Stephen Harper is now coming up with all these right-wing policies. You're right, he is. He's going to recriminalize or take that legislation out or overrule that legislation so that it'll still be, possession will still be a crime. And in addition, he's saying stuff like God bless Canada at the end of every speech. And no Canadian prime minister has ever invoked the deity when they give a speech to the Canadian people. So, he's a real Bush clone, but unfortunately it's a minority government. Hopefully we'll get rid of him real quick.
Well, Harper said, we're going to hold criminals to account. This is people that are smoking flowers to change their consciousness. He said, this government will send a strong message to criminals. If you do a serious crime, you're going to start doing serious time. Well, nice rhyme, dude, but so he's making criminals out of people that want to change their consciousness by smoking marijuana instead of drinking. Nice.
Yeah, he's part of that. He wants to go back to Leave It to Beaver crowd. I don't know.
Well, hopefully they get rid of that guy quicker. You've got a much more streamlined means of doing this. I mean,
our parliamentary system, where as soon as he comes up with a piece of legislation that the other parties don't like, they can vote him out. They can bring down the government and force us back into another election, and hopefully we'll do that sooner the better.
Yeah, all right. Thank you, Will. Thanks again for making the show international. Just in other drug news, the U.S. indicted 50 leaders of the Marxist rebel group, the Revolutionary Armed Forces of Colombia, the FARC, F-A-R-C. And they said they're behind 50% of the world's cocaine trade and 60% of the cocaine exported to the United States. I don't know if that's true. I mean, these right-wing narcotraficantes are also heavily involved in this. The practical effect is unclear, since 47 of the 50 commanders remained free in this vast country of Colombia, leading thousands of fighters in the group's relentless effort to topple President Alvaro Uribe's government. Three are in Colombian custody, and the United States will seek their extradition. So what about the other? Maybe they'll do like Noriega, right? Remember Noriega was a CIA asset, and then suddenly Papa Bush decided, hey, I'm going to boost my poll numbers a little, so I'm going to go make an arrest. We're going to arrest Manuel Noriega, the president, the dictator of Panama, who previously was Bush's pal, just like Saddam Hussein was Bush's pal. So they invaded this sovereign country, killed hundreds, perhaps even thousands. Some people say up to 4,000 civilians were killed by the U.S. invaders to arrest Manuel Noriega. Now, he's going to get out soon. Because when was that, like 89 or something? And I wonder what this guy is going to have to say. So that could be happening. That could be another deal. But here, this line is instructive. I mean, people in the United States, there are some people that want to do cocaine. And the vast majority of them that I've ever run into do it recreationally. I mean, you always run into a certain people, just like with alcohol. In fact, maybe a larger percentage of alcohol. But people with cocaine that do damage to themselves and their lives. And, I mean, it's very sad, and it should be a medical and psychological problem dealt with that. Not like my buddy, who's doing 21 years. As he always said, I should have killed somebody. I'd be out for delivering cocaine to individuals that wanted to do it. Anyways, with billions of dollars in backing from the United States. So you wonder, where are our tax dollars going besides Iraq? Well, they're also going into this right-wing government in Colombia. Colombia has sprayed much of its drug crop acreage and carried out army offensives against the rebels. But the groups continue to control wide swaths of territory and been increasingly active in neighboring Ecuador and Venezuela, where it operates camps for its fighters and traffics cocaine. So none of this stuff is working. Ever, does this ever occur to you that it's all about spending? That, see, you and I are all about goals, right? We've got goals. I mean, some of us don't. Some of us just drift. Actually, I'm more of a drifter. But, I mean, I have some goals, and I want to accomplish things. But what they talk about, a war on terror, a war on drugs, it's perpetual. It's like 1984. Read Orwell if you haven't read it in a long time or if never read it. It was written about the Soviet Union. Now it applies directly to the United States. That's the brilliance of Orwell. But they don't intend to accomplish their goals. These things are permanent. There will always be a war on terror, and unless the American people wise up. There will always be a war on drugs, and what that does is transfer billions of dollars to from the private sector, from you and I, the wealth producers, in through the government, in the hands of their favored corporations and governments that support the corporations overseas. It's a racket. This is not a government. This is Bush and Sons Incorporated, Bush Co. All right. Is that all on that? Oh, yeah. And one of the things that interdiction does, one of the things like these anti-drug programs do, is they ensure that there will be a continuing trafficking, continuing traffic in cocaine or marijuana or whatever, because it artificially keeps the price of the drug high. Because if they allowed unlimited growth and processing and importation and consumption, people could probably go get cocaine for $10 a gram or something like that, right? So by stopping the percentage of it, by making it dangerous for people to grow it and process it and smuggle it and sell it and consume it, they ensure, have no idea what it is, probably over $100 a gram or something like that. So it's all a Mobius strip. Remember that thing, Mobius, M-O-B-I-U-S? Look that one up. It's one of my favorite deals. But it's just a loop that feeds each other, and we're paying the cost. We work, and then they suck out 20% to 30% of our income. Well, that's if you're middle class or below. They don't take that much if you're real wealthy. We don't get it back. Their buddies get it back. It's a racket. We're being screwed. Hello? This is WRIF. I'm Peter Werby. This is the Night Call Show, 313-298-WRIF. Here's Dennis in Windsor as well. Dennis, hi. It's Peter Werby.
Hi, Peter. How are you?
Doing great. Thanks for joining us.
You're welcome, Ellie. First of all, to correct that guy from Ontario,
yeah,
you were 100% right. Vafanculo. That's the way you say it.
Vafanculo.
Yeah. If you say, my vafanculo, that means, why don't you go, you know? Va means go.
Oh, yeah, that's right.
So, my vafanculo is another way of saying it, but you were 100% right. He mispronounced it all the way around. He
well,
was talking about
I gotta say, it's not me. It's the Supreme Court Justice Antonin Scalia who said that in church.
You believe that?
No, he did.
I believe it.
No,
they
he did.
Say anything anywhere.
There's no doubt. There is no doubt that he said it. But then he came up with this thing that seems that it says, go away, or I don't agree with you.
He lied.
Yeah,
okay,
he
all I know.
Yeah.
I lived in the U.S. for about 9 years, and I moved there in 1998. Now I'm back in Windsor because of the healthcare costs over there and how I noticed that everything's become governmental, where, like, the president and it's all the states, they're running everything, and they're running all the middle-class people out of the U.S. Like, I think basically my whole picture is that there ain't going to be no more middle class people over there because the U.S. is just eating up all the money out of them, no matter where you go.
You mean the government?
All about money.
The government, you mean?
Yeah, the U.S. government. They're just chewing up the middle class people of the U.S., and I feel real bad for those citizens over there. And I'm glad I took the chance to move back to Canada. You know, it's a shame that they should just get together and take their country back. That's my personal opinion.
That's all we want. Thank you, Dennis. Appreciate your call. Let's see. Oh, yeah. Here's something, too. Remember those tax cuts? And that was another thing. Like 4 and 5 years ago, people were saying, we're getting so much. I'm making $40,000 a year, and my taxes are going to go down so incredibly. The first data to document, this is from the New York Times, big gain for rich seen in tax cuts for investments. Do you think? The first data to document the effect of President Bush's tax cuts for investment income show that they have significantly lowered the tax burden on the richest Americans. They have significantly lowered the tax burden on the richest Americans, reducing taxes on incomes of more than $10 million by an average of about $500,000. So these people that are making $10 million a year, that are already making more money than they could possibly consume or spend every year, just got a tax break of $500,000. These people are nuts. They're absolutely nuts. If those tax breaks would go to the people that deserve them, the hardworking middle class and working class people, what would we do? We'd go and spend it. That would energize the economy. Instead, they give it off to their rich pals. Right, here's Chris in Dearborn Heights. Hi, Chris. You're on the air.
Peter, it's an honor to speak with you.
Well, thank you. It is an honor to speak with you, Chris.
Honestly, I think Dennis had a great point. It'd be great to have this country back, wouldn't it?
Yep.
But the whole reason I called, the creation versus evolution, the evolution fish recently found in, I believe it was Canada.
Yeah.
And the Christians believing in creation. I just wanted to share this idea. One of our high school teachers explained to us that, well, he can't speak directly upon time as far as God goes, but God's day has no definition. In other words, the world could have been created in 7 days, assuming his time couldn't be, so to speak, in seconds or days or minutes.
Or billions of years.
Exactly.
Yeah.
They both share the same timeline. This evolution fish found in Canada supports creation. Do you understand what I'm saying?
Well, you can go anywhere with that argument. I mean, you can't have science and religion on the same territory. And, all the religious people I know, I'm not one, but all the religious people I know, they go to church, they pray, they go to synagogues, they pray, they go to mosques, they pray, whatever. And then they realize there's a material world out there that also has other qualities, properties, and definitions to it. And they deal with that as a separate realm. Once you start mixing them, and I've talked about this a jillion times, once you start mixing religion and anything else, it gets nuts because it already has its answers. It's fixed. That doesn't have the scientific method that's always looking to get deeper explanations of phenomena in the world. So, I mean, it's nice. God created the world in 7 days, whether it's 7 of our days or 7 billion years or whatever. And the religious people I know don't feel any need to exquisitely, make it, well, I can't think of the word I'm looking for, reconcile. They don't feel any need to exquisitely reconcile science and religion or religion and politics. I mean, oftentimes, because their sense of religion is about bringing a spirit manifest in the world of peace and justice, in other words, attempting to bring heaven on earth, as opposed to these people that see religion as a way you punish people. I don't know. Actually, I'm winding up somewhere. I'm not even sure where I'm going. All right. Thanks a lot. Appreciate your call. We'll be right back.
And now, a word from the Riff Legal Eagles. Unless otherwise stated, all entrants for WRIF contests must be at least 18 years of age and a legal resident of the United States. A household is eligible to win one contest per 30 days every 6 months for prizes valued at $600 or higher. Radio Media Detroit and its affiliates, promotional sponsors, advertising and promotional agencies, and other radio and television stations in the Detroit ADI are not eligible to participate. One entry per person. No purchase or other consideration is necessary to participate in a contest.
contest. Void where prohibited. Prizes are non-transferable or redeemable for cash. 101WRIF reserves the right to substitute any prize for one of equal or greater value. By participating in the contest, contestants consent to the broadcast and or publication of their name, voice, face, and or likeness without compensation. Participants listening online at www.wrif.com may receive audio that is delayed by as much as 60 seconds later than the over-the-air transmission, which could potentially affect chances of winning. General contest rules are available online at www.wrif.com or during regular business hours at the WRIF Studios, 1 Radio Plaza, Detroit, Michigan, 48220. This is WRIF.com.
Someone said that I misspelled Mobius, the Mobius strip. It is, let me make sure. Let me see. M-O-B-I-U-S. Isn't that what I said? Maybe I said something different. Anyways, Mobius strip. And thank you for kindly correcting me. I always appreciate it. Nice person wrote in to say that for me. And let's see, here's Jacob writing from Finland, from Oulu, Finland. I do not wait for you to get sick to pray for you. I will pray for you almost every day as you are a beacon of truth that your country needs and keeps us in a different corners of the world. Okay. All right. Hey, let me see. Here's something else where we wonder where our money's going. We don't have to really figure it out. ExxonMobil has let me read this story. Skyrocketing energy prices propelled ExxonMobil Corporation to the top of the 2006 Fortune 500 list and consigned Walmart Stores Incorporated to the number two spot on the magazine's annual ranking of the nation's largest publicly traded companies. Isn't that nice? Skyrocketing energy prices. You don't think it was maybe gouging, the fact that they were screwing us that had to do with that? Now, Hugo Chavez, the Venezuelan president, he is trying to peg oil at $50 a barrel, period. It would stay like that, so there wouldn't be this escalator going up and down. Now, who is looking after our interests? George Bush defends ExxonMobil's profits, where, of course, if they're going up and up and up, they're taking advantage they are taking advantage of the price. Because if they charged if their price was coordinated with what they cost, their profits would remain the same. The fact that they are now, I mean, think about this, you know, going way above what they have been. Walmart prides itself, for all the problems with Walmart, it prides itself on low prices and making a fortune. Exxon, of course, prides itself on high prices and making a fortune and screwing us along the way. So a lot of people, I don't know, I don't even know how you people feel about Hugo Chavez, the president of Venezuela. He's quite a character, that's for sure. But here's someone who appears to have the interest not only of the Venezuelan people at heart, because what he does, rather than saying, for instance, that Bush is enforcing this law, let's see here, the Bush administration confirmed that it expected the government to waive about $7 billion in royalty over the next 5 years for ExxonMobil. So ExxonMobil is going to have to pay $7 billion less in royalty fees to the United States. Thank you, George W. Bush. I mean, isn't his middle name Oil? Isn't it George Oil? Oh, no, it's W. Bush. I thought it was George Oil Bush or something like that. Now, the difference is that Venezuela is telling ExxonMobil, you're paying our government more money for the oil you're extracting for Venezuela, or you're out of the country. We're getting more money from ExxonMobil, and then we're going to take it, and we're primarily going to help the people of Venezuela, but we're also going to help people everywhere from Boston and New York, where Venezuela provides cheap or sometimes even free fuel and fuel for poor communities, all over the Caribbean, Cuba as well, where there's a lot of poor people. So, yet, of course, Chavez is being portrayed as this menace now. Maybe that's another place they will try to invade to get the heat off of them. That is, you know, the Bushevics. All right, let's go to Andre. Andre is in Russia? I don't know. Hey, Andre, you're on the air.
Yeah, how you doing, Peter? I'm actually from Sterling Heights here in Michigan, but originally, yeah, I am from Russia.
Oh, okay. So you're not in Russia now. Okay, good.
No. Yeah. What? Actually, the immigration is one of those topics that I really like to talk about myself, just because I'm foreign myself and I came to the United States 5.5 years ago. And yeah, I am legal status. I have a green card and everything. But when I first came in this country, I started off working with a bunch of illegal immigrants. And I tell you that the jobs that illegal immigrants pick up, it's the least paying jobs and the dirtiest jobs there is to do. So like saying that right now we should kick out all the illegal immigrants and stuff, I think it's just one of not smart things to do, just because our economy could go down. Simple example, all the food that's been supplied, vegetables and stuff like that,
mm-hmm.
they've been served in this humongous factory that once we served, we did we cleaned windows for it.
Yeah.
The company. So it was a lot of illegal Mexican workers. And I asked them how much were they getting paid. They said $5 an hour, which is below the minimum range. And,
sure.
Yeah, our government don't know about it, that, which is makes our food and our groceries to be delivered at the stores cheaper prices. If we put up some other workers in there, we pay them about $9 an hour. Then for the same head of broccoli that you pay 99 cents right now, you'd be paying $1.89.
Well, the other thing, Andre, is there's no real way. I mean, if no matter how you cut the immigration problem, it can't be solved by enforcement. You cannot round up 8 million people without creating an immense social chaos, because some people, they're here illegally, and then they have legal kids. What are they going to do, send the mom and dad back to Salvador and allow the kids to stay? So the solution is not, I mean, I don't know where the solution is. This whole thing about guest workers will wind up like Kuwait or some of these countries, or Dubai, that has this large workforce, particularly at the lowest levels of employment, like you're talking about, that have no right to vote and no control over their employment circumstances. So it's a hell of a problem, and that's why I was saying that people ought to sit back and kind of wait to see what shakes out rather than starting to portray anyone as their enemy. Also, there's not, according to Bush, there's not great unemployment, so these jobs, it's not like Americans would be rushing to take these jobs that have been stolen from us by Mexican immigrants. All right, Andre, thank you. I appreciate your comments. Let's see here. Here is MD in Westland.
Hello, Peter.
Hi, MD.
How are you?
Doing great.
Good, good, good. Well, I just wanted to make a little comment on something that you said earlier about the economy and how you have a certain class of people that, you know, are hurting. And we've gone through this over you know, the course of years here. And actually, see, my opinion on this is that this is the United States. This is the, you know, land of opportunity as far as, you know, any race, color, creed, or, you know, anything like that. And I'll tell you, as a white male, I don't like the Ku Klux Klan, and I don't like the NAACP. Everybody needs to, you get out there and you bust your butt. You know, and you will make it.
Well, wait a minute. What about the GM workers busting their butt? What about the Delphi workers busting their butt? What about the Kraft workers busting their butt? What about 100 other firms that bust their butt? White collar, blue collar. I'll tell you, MD, it sounds like maybe you could say this 20 years ago, but I don't know now. I mean, people are busting their butt. And they're talking, you know, these employers are talking about paying them half or what they used to.
But are they really trying to, you know, improve their situations? Are these people, do these people really have any goals?
Maybe their goal is to be a good worker. They were told, here, all right, come work at Union Carbide or come work at Delphi or GM. Do your job according to what you were hired in to do. One would expect that you don't also have to get a degree in engineering like the one fellow's doing, just in case, you know, the biggest corporation, what was the biggest corporation in the world, goes belly up. Most people figure, or at least used to figure, that there was security in doing a job well in a corporation that was responsible for providing profits to its shareholders and at the same time also paying a good, decent living wage to their employees. They did their job. The people that screwed up are the people at the top, and I don't understand why the people that are, in a sense, just carrying out the policy, not in a sense, but are just carrying out the policies of those making them, have to pay the cost. All right, thanks a lot. I appreciate your call. Here's Ben in Elgin, Illinois. Ben, hi, it's Peter Werbe. You're on the air.
Hey, Peter. Ben from White Rose here.
Okay, well, wait a minute. Let's not let you get away without telling people a little bit. This is Ben. Can I say your last name?
Sure.
This is Ben Birch. Ben Birch is the webmaster of WhiteRoseSociety.org. WhiteRoseSociety.org is where my show and many, many other progressive left liberal shows are archived. It's an absolutely critical, crucial part of this galaxy of speaking truth to power. And Ben, I hope this doesn't embarrass you, but you are wonderful and doing wonderful work.
Thank you, and we're doing more of it. We've started a venture called Head On Radio Network,
okay,
which can be found at headonradionetwork.com, and we're actually putting together a broadcast network.
Really? Well, you wrote me about that, and I have to say, I wasn't real encouraging, was I?
Well, you know, it is an uphill fight, especially with zero funding, where we're taking the money we get from White Rose. We've got some personal savings in it. We've got a grant from the Carpenters and Millwrights Union in West Virginia.
Really? Well,
yeah,
that's great.
And that's all the money we got right now. And we're putting together a business plan. We've got a professional business plan writing company working for us. And we're hoping to attract some investors. But if there are any investors out there listening, well, you know where to find us.
That's right. And whenever you miss this show or you want to say, gee, I wonder what I sounded like when I called 313-298-WRIF, you can go to whiterosesociety.org, and there will be the show, and there will be me, and there will be you, and there will be Ben. Go ahead.
And in fact, we have your shows going back like 3 years now.
You do indeed.
Including the old IE America shows. Anyways, the reason I called, you know, the problem with any fossil, I went to the University of Chicago. You know, you go to the University of Chicago, you're going to a school full of really bright people. There was a fellow in my dormitory who had about the biggest collection of trilobites, you know, those Devonian era, fossils of the, you know, that became extinct,
uh-huh.
You know, just before the Permian. And, they're interesting creatures. They were clearly the dominant life form on Earth at that time, and they're all gone now. And, you know, he was a dyed-in-the-wool creationist.
Really?
Oh yes, absolutely, you know, Baptist through and through, creationist through and through. And I asked him, what do you think these things are then? He says, oh, God created those when he created the earth in order to deceive mankind.
Well, he fooled me.
So, you know, there is it's really not the case that you can ever find a missing link that will satisfy these people, because what they believe is an act of faith, not an act of logic or an act of intellect.
Well, it never occurred to me, or it doesn't occur to me, that there's any reason even to suspect that there was any divine origin to the world or our lives.
I mean, modern science requires no God. It can't exclude a God because you can't exclude something by lack of evidence. That's one of the rules
sure.
of logic. But modern science, absolutely, you know, and I've worked in high energy physics, I've worked in nuclear physics, you know, and I think I understand just a little bit about it, requires no God at all to function.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, well, what I meant by that, I mean, it could very well be that somehow that this was all divinely created, but there's no evidence, or there's nothing to suspect it, or the proposition doesn't come from a source that would make one want to put it forth as a hypothesis.
Agreed.
Yeah.
Agreed. I can't be an atheist because being an atheist is another act of faith. It is where you go from being an agnostic, which says there is no proof of God, to the act of faith that says there can be no proof of God.
Well, in that definition, I would say it was definitely agnostic. But it always sounded a little weak to me. I understand. I mean, formally, precisely, you are absolutely correct. But I mean, in a world where people try to shove religions down your throat, here in the Middle East, Asia, everywhere, it's always pleasing to me to just be able to define myself in more absolute terms. But I could easily be convinced in a conversation with you, Ben, to put it in the same terms you are.
The problem is, I have to say I would never hold my breath waiting for some proof of God. I don't think it's going to happen. I think the odds are that there isn't one, has never been one, never will be one, and that the universe created itself.
Well, there's no reason. I mean, why do we even trouble ourselves with that? I mean, there's a lot more serious things in my life. Than that. They asked Bertrand Russell, the great philosopher and atheist, they asked, well, if there's no God, what's the meaning of life? And he said, what do you mean by the meaning of life? right?
Exactly.
I mean, we're here. They asked the Buddhists, they say, what's the meaning of life? And they say, chop wood, carry water. And you go, whoa, that has a lot of meanings to it.
Well, I know. My intention is to just enjoy every day I'm here.
There you
go. Knowing that when it's all done, I'm gone.
Well, maybe yes, maybe no. But I would say if there's a merciful God, you and I will be sitting at his feet, and these horrid people that claim allegiance to him will be burning forever in hell.
Well, if you understand the humane teachings of the teacher Jesus, I just don't think you can justify any war ever that way.
I would think not. I would think not. All right. Hey, Ben, thanks a lot.
And
oh, good,
I,
good.
My
I thought that was you for a minute. I thought that was you for a minute. All right, Ben. Hey, email me. Let me know what's going on with this stuff.
I sure will, sir.
All right. Thank you very much. Even though I wasn't very encouraging when he told me he was going to try to put together a national network, I said, man, you need tens of millions of dollars. 313-298-WRIF. I'm Peter Werbe. Here is Greg in Washington Township out near the Octagon House, right?
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah, what's up?
That Ben's got quite a bark to his bite.
Yeah.
I'll be quick here because I know you got other callers, but there's so much I could go on for hours about the Bush administration. Has anybody noticed how there's chaos among the masses with this administration? It's like every week to 10 days it's something causing chaos for the middle class and the lower class to worry about. You know, we've got the ports deal, the airports, the immigration, now bombing Iran. He's trying to keep us real busy, isn't he?
Yeah, indeed. And on the screen, it said you wanted to talk about this Bush leak. And
oh, the leak thing, yeah.
Well, in some ways, this is the key item. Why is this man still in office? He said...
I know.
His own words. Now, wait a minute. One of the reasons I didn't bring this up right away, it's kind of complicated. But someone, the name of a covert CIA agent, Valerie Plame, wound up in a Washington Insider's column, and an aide to Vice President Cheney was indicted for obstruction of justice and perjury in trying to block this, to try to find out who it was. Bush said, if there is a leak out of my administration, this was in September 2003, I want to know who it is, and if the person has violated the law, the person will be taken care of. Well, it turns out it was George W. Bush himself.
Uh-huh. Yep.
He discovered it was himself.
Yeah.
And they did it in order to stop the... Jeez, this is complicated. That they knew that the so-called intelligence about Saddam Hussein seeking weapons of mass destruction, like trying to get these tubes to create uranium and all this crap like that, they knew it was a lie. And when the husband of the CIA agent went public and said, no, there's nothing, I checked it out, they said they got to find some way to smear him. So Bush allowed this information. So it's not a leak when he does it. It's declassifying.
Right.
I mean, this is a high crime and misdemeanor. The idea that Valerie Plame's name became known to the world, suddenly everyone she's ever had contact with in the diplomatic world in their own country is suspect by the that country's government.
Well, is this enough to impeach him now? I mean, it's like we can't seem to find anything to impeach him.
Well, there we're going to the ITMFA. Did you check that out?
No.
You know what that is?
No.
I can't say. You got a computer?
Yeah.
You go to you know how to spell my last name? Werbe. You go to peterwerbe.com, you can go to ITMFA. He has committed numerous high crimes and misdemeanors that arises to the level of impeachable offenses.
Is anybody actually doing it? Any congressmen? Are they proposing anything?
No. I mean, maybe. I don't even think. You know what? If the Democrats swept the House and the Senate and had the votes... the majority votes in Congress, I still don't think they would do it. Perhaps the wonderful John Conyers, the representative from Detroit, who actually goes back so far, he introduced the articles of impeachment for Richard Nixon.
Uh-huh.
He would probably do it again, but these weak-kneed Democrats, they probably wouldn't do it.
Yeah, this, another thing I want to bring up is this 4.4% unemployment. Are we being fed false numbers here?
Well, I mean...
Where are they getting that from?
Well, there is an old thing that says, figures don't lie, but liars can figure.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, it's hard to really get a handle on it. There's been a lot of job creation, hundreds of thousands of job creation, but as people lose good jobs, high-paying jobs, union jobs, they wind up, you know, this whole process, they wind up working at Walmarts.
Yeah.
And So there are people that are working. There are millions of people working under what under salaries or for salaries under what they previously earned. There's people that are working less, in other words, part-time than they had previously. And then they have what they call discouraged workers, which means their unemployment has run out and they no longer register with the federal employment agency that they're supposed to. And they're not counted as unemployed.
No.
So, yeah, the unemployment and the underemployment and employment at lesser wages is probably much, much greater. The age of the middle class, the income of the middle class has been dropping over during Bush's regime. So, to that extent, no, it's not. Are you in a bowling alley?
Me? No, why?
Kind of sounds like it.
Really? I'm sitting here in my quiet room.
Your quiet room. I hear like pins, you know, bowling pins dropping.
Really?
Yeah. It must be your phone. Or maybe somebody.
Maybe it's a phone.
Yeah. All right. Hey, thanks a lot.
Okay. Thanks, guy.
Appreciate your call. 313-298-WRIF. Let me see. I'll just read this. This is from the Institute for Public Accuracy. You can go to accuracy.org. I get a lot of my guests from them. The Washington Post reports today, April 7th, that, quote, President Bush authorized White House official I. Lewis Scooter Libby to disclose highly sensitive intelligence information to the news media in an attempt to discredit a CIA advisor whose views undermine the rationale for the invasion of Iraq, according to a federal prosecutor's account of Libby's testimony to a grand jury. Now, you're going, what? Well, it is pretty complicated, but this was the leak. If you've heard anything about this, this is a man that would compromise United States security. Remember that Bush was the ultimate underminer of U.S. security by having the guard of this country down so low that September 11th easily occurred when he had gotten warning after warning. So let me see if there's anything in here that... Now, I mean, it's all this stuff, release of intelligence, raises questions. It does more than raise questions. We've got a lot of stuff on here. A concerted effort to discredit Bush credit, critic. A concerted effort to discredit Bush critic. Let's see. As he drew, I don't know. Either you got to know about this or you don't. I don't know why this is in this pile, but Wisconsin communities vote on Iraq withdrawal. Thousands of voters turned out in Wisconsin to offer a purely symbolic but heartfelt message. Bring the troops home from Iraq. By margins overwhelming in some places and narrow in others, voters in 24 of 32 communities approved referendums last Tuesday calling for an immediate withdrawal of U.S. troops from Iraq. This is good. But Bush says we're not pulling out. Some open lines you've been trying to get in all night. 313-298-WRIF. Here is Jim and Davison. Jim, hi. It's Peter Werby. You're on the air.
How you doing, Peter?
Doing good.
Thank you for keeping the intelligentsia of this country high-ended, because, damn, with Rush Limbaugh living in these states, I feel stupider by the second, even being damned by his comments.
There you go.
But I have to laugh. I felt in a short time of listening, and I have felt my intelligence stay at the high IQ level that I earned so many years ago, retained just by listening every Sunday while at work.
All right, thanks.
But I felt you needed a good laugh for the night, because I don't know if you get too many of these, but I had an epiphany one night, and I brought this to my wife, and she about fell over laughing her ass off. I said, you know, Bush has struck me so much as a Elvisier, so to say, Elvis impersonating version of Adolf Hitler and the insanity of what he has done. Just slicker.
Wow.
Going here, going there, raising all sorts of hell, just not quite taking over things yet, but selling the living daylights out of our asses.
Well, he's not really had any successes, has he? Except he's made a lot of money for his pals. All right, thanks a lot. Appreciate your call. Let's see. Agnostic, JV, Jerry writes in here. Agnostic is not entirely convinced. Atheist refuses to believe. A, against, as an apathetic. I don't know. Etymology, there's a whole thing here. Where is this here? Etymology. A person who holds a view that any ultimate reality as God is unknown and probably unknowable. That would be an agnostic. And so I guess I'm an agnostic, but broadly one who is not committed to believing in either the existence or the non-existence of God or a God. Well, like I said, I've never seen any good reason or any suggestion of a reason why any divine intervention exists in our world. I mean, if you just believe it on faith, Gaia is a pagan goddess, isn't it? All right, let's see. We'll go back to our phones. 313-298-WRIF. Here's Paul in Brighton. Paul, hi. You're on the air.
Hi. How are you doing?
Doing great. What's up?
Peter Warby. I've been listening to you for a long time.
Well, thanks.
Yeah, I always like listening to your show, and I get all this information from the History Channel, and plus what I know.
Yeah.
And nobody wants to talk about the marijuana issue, but, you know, it's been blown way out of proportion. Anselin himself has taken over way back about almost 100 years ago now, and the blacks, the Mexicans, they're trying to stop the people from coming into America. And they were smoking that green stuff, and they didn't like it because they were trying to stop them. So Anselin came out with a
You're doing a little too much shorthand. You're talking about Harry Anslinger, who was the first head of the Narcotics Bureau, who began an insane racist jihad against Mexicans and African Americans, who he saw as the primary users. In fact, Harry Anslinger at one time wanted to arrest the major swing jazz artists of the 1930s, like Count Basie and Duke Ellington and Fats Waller. Fortunately, maybe J. Edgar Hoover was his boss, who was also nuts. But at least was smart enough to know that wasn't workable.
Yeah, and now we get 100 years later, and we've got the same problem. We have people running drugs back and forth. We've seen the tunnels. They do it daily, monthly. We can't stop it. I think the only way, you have to remember, too, this is a great way for us to make fuel. Half the time of a tree.
Yeah, but hemp for fuel and all its other industrial uses is a whole lot different than the intoxicating the plant with the intoxication capacity that people are growing hydroponically and what have you. They've really gotten that down to a fine art. But the war on drugs, particularly, I mean, nobody can make an argument for marijuana being harmful to people. Kids shouldn't smoke it, and people ought to, when they're growing, and ought to keep their minds and their bodies as clear as possible. But adults, and even if it's harmful, tell people it's harmful, and then if they want to do it, it's up to them. Not a bunch of guys with guns that are going to send you to jail for 20 years for smoking flowers. All right, let's go to Ryan in Toledo. Ryan, hi, you're on the air. Go ahead.
How's it going, Peter?
Going great.
Yeah, I think your show's pretty big in bowling alleys. I remember hearing pins crashing last week on the show for some reason.
Something about bowling, yeah.
I guess so. A couple of things. First of all, I always get a kick out of these Republicans that call up telling people to get off their butts, bust their butts. And they've got the most well-vacationed president in office. They talk about ingenuity, and yet the Republicans want to, you know, cut out science and put all this faith in creationism and kind of blocking anybody who wants to speak the truth about what's going on in our global environment. They talk about, you know, small government, and yet the largest national debt in the history of this country. But the question I had for
wait, I love all that. I'm thinking, why don't I write that down? Let me just go back to the first thing, about busting your butt. Yeah, Bush, when he was before 9/11, people say, he changed that. But he said, I'm going to work 24/7, 24 days a month, 7 months a year. And he was the ultimate party boy slacker, that the only reason he's probably not in prison is because he was rich. Anybody who was like a working class kid, working class white kid or a minority, and did all the things that he did and did the drugs that he did and all that, it'd be right in the slammer. Anybody that was in the middle class and screwed up in school and then screwed up in business as badly as he did and did illegal things in business would also be running a hard road. So, yeah, very good. That's very good.
Whenever you bring that up, they always just say, well, Clinton did this. It's never really directly answering. When you throw it back in their faces, it's always, well, you know, Clinton, blah, 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 blah. It's it's never like, you know, if both people are doing something wrong, you call a spade a spade. They've both done something wrong, but it's always, well, this guy did this, so we're entitled to do this. It's across the board whenever you hear anything on the radio with these guys. But my question for you is this. The midterms coming up, there's a lot of talk that the Democrats might finally win one.
Yeah.
And I actually think that's not true. I think they're going to find a way to blow this one like a pyromaniac sneezing on his last match like they always do.
They can very easily, what's the opposite of what they usually say? They could snatch defeat from the jaws of victory.
Right.
And also because probably Bush is going to do something. I mean, Karl Rove, Dick Cheney, they've got something for the boy king in store for all of us, really, whether it's attacking Iran and all hell will break loose if Iran is attacked. And they could very possibly think that would benefit them, particularly if there was a retaliatory attack somewhere inside of the United States. But hopefully people would realize that it's the insane policies of this government that has created the context and make sure to boot this guy out. Because even now, used to be the only thing that the Republicans scored better on in polls was security, and now they don't even do that. The people think Democrats could do better, probably because they think they can't imagine anybody doing anything worse. All right, Ryan, thanks for calling in from Toledo. Now, this is weird. This is from Pamela listening in Montana. Having weird stuff happening listening to your show tonight. Napster is popping up. Still Napster? I thought that was long gone. It's popping up despite my anti-pop-up program. It is an intrusive pop-up that has sound and is slow and difficult to remove. Then a voice comes on. Thanks for listening to WRIF online and a sort of signing off message. Then you continue talking and the show is back. This has happened twice. I've not noticed anything different happening. Well, anybody else getting that? Let me know, because I will bring it to the attention of our engineers. Pamela, I will send this on to them. Call talkyes@yahoo.com. The Indigo Girls, I said, have you heard the new song by Pink with the Indigo Girls called Dear Mr. President? I have the link. I actually have heard it. It's a gorgeous song, she says. Dear Mr. President, come take a walk with me. Yeah, it's incredible. What, I don't get it. By Pink. Who is, now I'm showing my ignorance on this. I know who the Indigo Girls are, but I don't know who Pink is. Are they? Anyways, before I show my complete ignorance in this matter, someone call and tell me what's going on here or email me. 313-298-WRIF. We're open line right up till 1 a.m., so let me see. There's one open line as well. They're commercial free and open line. Here is Mike in Clio. Is that or Clio? Clio.
Yeah, it's Clio.
Right. Go ahead. You're on the air.
Hello, Peter. Hi. Pleasure to speak with you. I've just started listening to your program here a month or so ago. I'm a truck driver, work at night.
Welcome.
Enjoy it and agree with you wholeheartedly and everything. I didn't really have any question or point to make. Just wanted to let you know I was listening, and there's a lot of us out here. I've been telling people to listen to your show and hit your website, too. So.
Well, that's good. Did you get a chance to go tonight so you can see what ITMFA is?
No, I have not. And to tell you the truth, I don't even own a computer.
But you know what? Don't, Mike. Don't. If I wish I had every hour of my life that I'll never get back. I mean, today my printer wouldn't work. I just, and my wife's saying, come on, let's go for a walk. It's a beautiful day outside. I gotta fix this. So I'm shutting it off and I'm going into the properties and trying to, you know, it is such a time and money drain. And you know what? We did fine without them. We did absolutely.
I'm hearing you. You know, I haven't been able to take the leap. Every once in a while I get the urge, but it's just another appliance that I'd have to have someone else to fix, and I'm like you. I just, so.
All right. Thank you, Mike, and thanks for listening. Welcome to the show.
Yep, thank you.
All right, bye now. Oh, where are we here? Somebody I wanted to grab. Yeah, here is Jeff in Dearborn. Jeff, hi. You're on the air.
Hey, can you hear me?
I can hear you.
Hey, you know what's funny, man? You got a lot of issues. I wrote down the one about marijuana.
Hey, I'll tell you what. I practically want to join normal because I think it's a marijuana prohibition with the way they the government is going. It's like one time I got arrested for having a pot pipe. I had to go do a drug test for a year for having a pot pipe in my private house when I was taking care of my elderly father.
What do you mean it's almost like prohibition? It is prohibition.
Yeah, it's marijuana prohibition.
Yeah.
I got to be honest with you. I consider myself a conservative, but I'm not a Republican. I'm conservative on a lot of things. But let me see. We want to talk. I wrote this. You know, it is marijuana prohibition, blah, blah. We all know that. It's a joke. So come on, man. Give me a break. Let's get. I almost feel like moving to Canada. We all know about what they're doing.
Well, not anymore. They got this brand new conservative prime minister in there, and he said no to the legislation that was already at work, which would have legalized small amounts of marijuana for personal possession, which to me is extraordinarily important. Another reason to get rid of Stephen Harper. What a loser. All right. Thanks a lot. Appreciate your call. Let's see. Here is John in Harper Woods. John, hi. It's Peter Werby on WRIF. You're on the air.
Hi, Peter.
Hi.
How you doing?
I'm doing great.
I've emailed you a couple times, but I ran across something that a former head of the Star Wars program under, I believe it was Reagan and Bush Sr., is saying that the major suspect in the 9/11 should be considered Cheney because of how the military stood down when the planes were coming in, and they knew they were coming in.
Well, I'll tell you what. Just like a generation ago, the Kennedy Commission, the Warren Commission, that gave this pronouncement on who killed John Kennedy, that was the lone assassin of Lee Harvey Oswald, satisfied virtually no one and left this question open forever. I wouldn't go so far as to say, well, some people do say the 911 Commission was a whitewash, but there's still so many answered questions, and all you got to do is go to the internet, and it just is mind-blowing. So these kind of questions and these accusations and things like that, why were these planes ordered to stand down? They said there must have been a military order. Where could that come from? All of that has to be answered, or 30 years from now, people are still going to be suspecting George W. Bush and Dick Cheney as being directly behind 911.
Well, I know that like just months prior that they said that they passed a law that said that only Bush or that Cheney could make the military stand down in a situation like that, and neither of them were available at the time when it was happening to make tell them to do that. I also ran across a site that said that seven of the hijackers in the 9/11 official report were found alive. A lot of them said that they had their passports stolen, but it still ended up in the official report.
Well, you know, I did see something about that. I mean, it's sort of weird that they found in the wreckage of the World Trade Center, like, intact passports of some of these people, and that there was I've never been able to sort it all out. That there was actually misidentification of who the actual hijackers were. Well, that's what I mean. I just got to tell you, I don't know where to go with it, or there are sites that seem totally out in outer space, and others that ask questions that I can't answer, and some that seem on the face of it preposterous, and on the other, in fact, on my website, you can go to my website, and there is a 911 page, and there's something in there like 36 unanswered questions. Well, why are there any unanswered questions, I think, is really what faces us. And besides that, I mean, if people want to do the work on it, fine. It drives them. There are conspiracies. So when I say conspiracy theories, I'm not denigrating them. But conspiracies are extraordinarily hard to prove. And it always seems to me, like in the case people say there was this massive conspiracy to kill John F. Kennedy. If you have started having 20 and 30 people involved in it, someone's going to talk on their deathbed. Yeah, I mean, that's for sure. But one of the things that we do know is that the Bush administration dropped the ball entirely in terms of intelligence and security. It was all out there. People were screaming bloody murder. You're not paying attention. That as Bush goes off on vacation, that there was a warning that Al-Qaeda was going to strike in the United States. Bush gets an advisory telling him that there's an immediate danger. He stays cutting brush. For that, he should have been impeached. Absolutely. All right, thanks a lot. Let's go to Doug in Detroit. I think he has an answer to my question. Hey, Doug, you're on the air.
Oh, yeah. First thing I wanted to say was my son just got baptized today. He was Douglas Dakota John DeGoyer.
Okay, great.
And then I wanted to say I agreed with you with your stance on marijuana. It should have been legalized long ago. The police and the government make more money off the
illegality of it.
Yes, exactly.
Wait a minute. Tell me about Pink.
Legalize it. They probably make more tax in it. You know.
How? What about Pink though?
What's that? Oh, Pink. I'm sorry. I forgot about that. Pink is actually a single artist. She is married or soon was married to Gavin Rossdale from Bush.
Okay.
Bush, the band that played around the 90s, they were big around the 90s.
Right, right. Not George W.
No, exactly.
What do the Indigo Girls have to do with Pink?
Well, it's just like a collaboration.
Okay.
Actually.
I see. All right. Well, thank you. And congratulations on the baptism of your son. Appreciate it. Let's see, here is Rich. Rich is in South Lyon. Hey, Rich, you're on the air.
Hey, Peter, how you doing?
Doing good.
Hey, listen, I just wanted to ask you something. I have to take you to task a little bit here about your stance on the government and the war on drugs.
Sure.
First of all, as a police officer that works in a suburban community, and I work primarily in narcotics enforcement, I can tell you that most narcotics teams, at least the teams that I've worked with, are not out to enforce narcotics laws against the casual user. I don't think you're going to find more than maybe 20% of any police force is really vehemently against people using marijuana. What people do in their own home on their own time is really their own business.
Well, listen, that could be true, and I think that there has been a reduction. But still, there's like 1 million marijuana arrests a year in this country.
Oh, I understand. That could be anywhere from an ounce to a roach. And,
right.
And personally, I don't think that you're correct. Arresting people for a joint or whatever, it is a waste of time. But there is one thing that I heard tonight that kind of irked me a little bit. How do you think that the government and or police departments and or local governments are making so much money or they're somehow wasting people's time by enforcing the drug laws? How do you think that is not helping people at all?
Well, there's billions of dollars, probably up towards $1 trillion that have been taken in tax money and given over to the war on drugs, and drugs are as prevalent as they ever were. They're more powerful than they ever were, and the corruption that they create from the countries in which they originate, whether it's cocaine or heroin or marijuana, continues, and it continues corrupting almost everyone that it comes in. Not everyone. I'm not putting that on you. I would say probably overwhelming majority of people involved in law enforcement and narcotics are honest and do their job with integrity. But still, as you know, that it's also been one of the great corrupting forces. But overall, the war on drugs creates clients for the prison industrial complex. Take away the laws against drugs, and, man, you'd empty these prisons out.
And let me ask you a quick question.
Sure.
How do you think – let me rephrase that. Have you ever heard of the way people conduct business? I'm not talking about the guy that's going – that's smoking a joint. I'm talking about people that are – their business is selling drugs. And I'm not talking about – let's just say with just strictly marijuana, someone that uses – marijuana but moves a large quantity. Say he's moving 50 pounds a week.
Yeah.
Have you ever dealt with or talked with anyone in your travels that does that? Because in my experience, it's been that people that work on a large scale in any type of narcotic use or scale like that, their business is A, violent, and B, it taps just on the, that's just touching the surface of the illegality. It is a gateway to other illegal activities. And primarily what I see is, because I've done a lot of work in Detroit, a lot of dog fighting, a lot of stuff that works into stolen property, into prostitution. I mean,
Well, sure. I mean, if it, one thing's illegal, it's pretty easy. I mean, the type of people that are involved in criminal activity, once you break one law, well, it's pretty easy to be involved in others. And it goes with the territory. I mean, the people that were distributing liquor 70 years ago, if my math is correct, were violent, involved in other crimes, extortion and robberies and what have you, as well as distributing liquor. It becomes legal, and they're nice pillars of our community, and they drive around in marked trucks, right?
Correct. But the only other point I was trying to make is that this is where it starts. This is where, for most people like myself in the profession that I'm in, this is the, you know, the heart of the matter. No one's trying to get into somebody's house because they think they have a quarter ounce in there. Who cares? It's the point of the people that are out there doing illegal things and snowballing it into, well, because you're infringing upon my business, people get shot.
Well, sure.
Neighborhoods are terrified.
Well, that's what they do when things are illegal. I mean, since I know police that have smoked marijuana, as well as judges and lawyers and school teachers and probably every profession on earth, and also some I know some people that have had unfortunate, encounters with other drugs. It's a widespread activity that seems to be irrepressible, even in countries where people are executed for even possession of drugs, places like China and Iran and what have you. It's a battle you can never win, and I don't know that the government has any right, in my view of things, to tell me what I can use to alter my consciousness as long as I'm not driving, hurting people. And if I'm doing harm to the community, for instance, by incapacitating myself so I need medical care, well, that should be granted. But, it should be understood that there is a bit of a cost. Most people I know, and I'm sure most people you know who have used drugs, including your fellow officers, are casual users that use it for recreation and hurt nobody.
Oh, I can't argue with you there. I have no problem. I believe it or not, I have no problem with someone. They want to sit home and smoke a joint. Hey, God bless them, you know. More power to them. But the whole point is there's this whole other business that goes on,
right,
that is never going to go away because, and I'm not saying it's because of the casual user. It's the easy money that these guys can make. And the whole thing is a vicious cycle because of the demand and because of the profitability and because of, you know, the low risk. Believe me, there's a really low risk of most people if they ever sold drugs, if they ever got caught, simply by the fact that the sheer numbers and the numbers that have dwindled in the police department, their enforcement has dwindled because of, obviously, tax problems.
Mm-hmm.
Money has become less available from the state, all that kind of stuff. The sheer fact that someone would ever get caught is really pretty small, and that's the part that really bothers me more than anything. The casual user, I don't think you'd find anybody around here that would really argue with that they really need to crack down on the casual user, the adult casual user. I have yet to break up a fight between two pot smokers. I have broken up so many family fights because of alcohol, and I think alcohol is definitely the more evil of the two, but that's really neither here nor there.
Well, you know what? It's neither here nor there. I should get some final calls. Rich, thanks for joining us.
No problem, Pete.
I appreciate it. Thanks for calling. Thanks for listening. Let's see. Here's another Peter. Peter from Ypsilanti. This is Peter Werby. Go ahead. You're on the air.
Hey, Peter. Two things. One, I wanted to reference a call you got a long time ago. It really irked me. It was somebody called in and basically accused your listening audience of being a bunch of slackers, potheads, et cetera. First of all, I don't smoke pot, and second of all, I work for a living. I work while I listen to your show sometimes. I drive pizzas. The second thing is, I think your previous caller really missed the point. The point is that, you know, the fact that the drugs are illegal is what causes the problem.
Sure.
If the drugs weren't illegal, there wouldn't be half the problems that there are. The other thing I want to say is that I used to deal ecstasy for several years while I lived in Seattle. And quite frankly, I never committed another crime. I've gotten a lot of driving tickets, but that's because I'm a horrible driver, which doesn't speak well for my profession. But the point is I dealt in ecstasy. I didn't kill anybody. I never fought anybody. I never stole from anybody. If the drugs weren't illegal, then first of all, they could replace all the money they're making on the prison system with taxes. And second of all, people wouldn't do stupid things like steal from other people. It really frustrates me, that whole...
Yeah, sure. Well, it is based, everything... That's what I said. If you have booze illegally, you've got Al Capone at the root of it. And the same things that were said about marijuana and all the other drugs, everybody's got such weird things happening in their background. Same things being said today about drug dealers. It was the same thing about the illegal booze at 70, 80 years ago. All right, thank you very much. I appreciate your opinion and your call. Let's see here. Where was I looking at something? Oh, yeah, here. So Karen says, she writes into calltalkyes@yahoo.com, Pink is a female pop singer from Philadelphia. Am I that out of it, or shouldn't, maybe I don't know pop singers. She used to have pink hair. Musically, she's okay. I wouldn't buy her album, but I'd buy Pink Floyd's album. Okay. Whatever with that. Doug from Downriver. Doug, hi. You're on the air.
How you doing, Pete? I'm also a police officer, and I got 2 points to make. One reference, a quick point about the drugs. They can legalize marijuana. That's fine. And both the previous caller and yourself are saying crime would go down, all would go down. Well, look at tobacco. I'm on the Downriver. I'm right on the river with Canada. Tobacco is legal, but it's still being smuggled over from Canada, because people can still get it cheaper by smuggling it from Canada than buying it the legal way.
Right.
Hence, people are going to still... A couple hundred pounds of marijuana coming across the river. It's going to continue. The drug trafficking is still going to continue. It's not going to lessen any crimes.
Of all the billions of dollars, probably people have estimated up towards $1 trillion that have been spent on it, and essentially it's gone into enforcement, into prison expansion, is that it hasn't worked. And what would happen if you just dropped all the laws? I don't know. I mean, I can't imagine it would be worse than what's happened to people. Why does the government say it is really terrible for you to smoke marijuana? All right, so most people say that's not so bad. Okay, how about things like crack cocaine and cocaine and heroin, speed and stuff like that? That sounds like pretty terrible stuff to me. I mean, I shouldn't say it sounds like. I would say that it is. But at some point, that has to be individual responsibility and not a law enforcement issue.
I agree with the previous caller about we give people eights and dime bags all the time, and who cares? It's just personal use. You're never going to see anybody go to prison for smoking and caught with an eighth of weed every single week. It's never going to happen, especially in the Detroit area. I just don't think it's a good idea to legalize it, but law enforcement mainly keys on the big people, not the people who are down the street buying an eighth of weed and taking home and smoke in their house. Most cops, they're not going to bother with it. They're in their house, they're harmless. But another point I had is about how you're talking about President Bush was to blame for 9/11. I don't know if you remember this, but in 97, Bill Clinton, Bin Laden was in Sudan, they gave Clinton a call saying that we got Bin Laden twice from his rhetoric about America. And he turned him down. He didn't want him. Then in 99, Jordan told America where he was at, and the U.S. had him on a Predator that was armed as a missile, and they didn't take him out either. That was under Clinton's administration.
Well, like I said earlier, I don't have any brief for Clinton, and I never was a big defender. I've spent most of the 90s criticizing him. And, if there's a whole string of intelligence failures, let's blame them all. All right, Doug, thank you very much. Appreciate your call. Is everybody going to tell me that Pink is not married to Gavin Rossdale of Bush? All right, if you're on the line waiting to tell me that, says she's just married some skater dude. All right, gotta keep that straight here. Let's see, where are we? I don't know. Scott, you going to tell me that?
Hello.
Hello. I can't. Your phone is messed up. We're going to have to let that go. All right. Chuck from Waterford. Go ahead. You're on the air.
Hi. Well, I was in Waterford when I called. Now I'm almost home in Davison. But I'm enjoying your show, Peter. I like the way you got the debate going between the police officers and the drug dealers. But
all right.
I just wanted to call and make a quick observation about, well, first, I think the fact that George W. Bush is still in office is a demonstration of the fact that our political system, the checks and balances, are breaking down.
Okay.
The very fabric of our society is at stake.
Yeah.
And the thing I wanted to bring up is about Delphine filing bankruptcy.
Right.
I feel sorry for that judge. I'm sure he's hoping that they'll get things worked out with the unions and all, but if it comes down to him deciding if he actually rules in favor of Delphi,
yeah,
I mean, that would set the president to break the back of the American Labor Union.
Well, I think that's one of the goals, certainly. Hey, I'll tell you, Chuck, I got to end the program right now, so I'm going to cut you a little short. Thanks a lot. I appreciate you being our last caller. All right, a couple of interesting interviews. Stay tuned for those. Thanks for listening. Thanks for calling. We'll talk live next week.
Like a song you just heard?
Oh, yeah!
Listen up.
Then head on over to the Digital Riff Music Store at WRIF.com and download your favorite riff tunes for just 99 cents.
Next song.
Stay connected.
With 101 WRIF and WRIF.com.
Everything that rocks.
You're listening to WRIF.com.
A similar thread to them. War is bad, obviously, and I'll get back to the obviously in a second, and particularly the Iraq War, where we have any number of authors saying that the pretext for the Iraq War was false. But you, particularly those of you listening right here in Detroit, the Motown great Edwin Starr saying, "War, what is it good for? Absolutely nothing." And one would think that would be the case. Who in the world would want war? Well, and an extraordinary book came across my desk. It's called Shadows of War, Violence, Power, and International Profiteering in the 21st Century. It's written by Carolyn Nordstrom. She's an associate professor of anthropology at the University of Notre Dame, and she's also the author of A Different Kind of War Story, the co-editor of Fieldwork Under Fire, Contemporary Studies of Violence and Survival, and The Paths to Domination, Resistance, and Terror. And these are all published by the University of California Press, as is Shadows of War. Welcome, Carolyn Nordstrom, to the Peter Werby Show.
Thank you. It's a pleasure to be here.
And now, what I was saying, Edwin Starr, is, you know, war, what is it good for? Absolutely nothing. You would think that everyone on the planet would just abhor it, but it does work for some people, doesn't it?
It does work for some people. There's no question about it.
Give us some examples.
First, let me tell you how I came to study war. I am an anthropologist, and most people don't think of anthropologists as studying war zones. They think of studying, you know, Indiana Jones type stuff or, you know, ancient civilizations. But people on the front lines are cultures, they're societies, and that's what we study. So my specialty is trying to figure out how people survive on the front lines. Who's out there? What is going on? Who's doing what to whom? So I literally have spent half my career on the front lines of various wars around the world. And I'm a scientist. I mean, I'm not there to try to prove a point. I'm not there to support one side or the other. I'm there to do scholarship, to do science.
Well, there is a pattern to your books. I was going to note that.
Absolutely.
Yeah. And when did this all come about? You said that you've been doing this for half your professional life.
Yeah.
So at some point you said, I'm not going to go to Utah and
pick up arrowheads.
Yeah, right. I want to go into some fire zone. What was the original motivation?
It was, I can tell you the day it happened, and it was in 1983. I was in Sri Lanka, and I was studying medical systems, and I got caught in severe political violence. The country blew. It was these terrible riots. One-sixth of the entire country was destroyed in 7 days, and I wasn't sure I was going to live through it. But I discovered two things. I discovered you can study war, which I did to survive it, and I discovered I had a gift for it. I'm just really calm on the front lines in the middle of a firefight. And there's patterns, and those patterns are culture, and that's what anthropologists do. So, you know, going back to your question about who profits, you know, I could tell you stories of average families. You know, you're a mom or you're a dad, and your 14-year-old son or daughter gets beaten up, tortured, and killed. What do you do? Some people turn to the Red Cross, some people turn to church, and some people turn to fighting. And for these people, that's a really legitimate thing to do. Whether we like it or not, if you shoot someone's family member, they probably will fight back, whether it's in Iraq or Burma or Colombia. And nothing's going to change that equation. But what's scary is that person has to buy a gun. And one of the things I've charted is the vast global system of weapons transfers and all that goes into making those weapons transfers possible. And people need money to buy weapons. So very, very poor people will sell anything they can, human labor, diamonds, blood diamonds, gold, coltan, which we use in our cell phones. It's a mineral that you find in Congo. They'll sell anything that they can at their fingertips to buy weapons. And when you start adding all this up, you're talking about hundreds of billions of dollars yearly going into this kind of war economy around the world. And those hundreds of billions are going into very powerful people's pockets.
So this is also part of the world economy. It's not just, we would all say, gee, it's unfortunate that there's wars. On the other hand, it's a very distinct part of international commerce.
You know, this is a great point. I love the way you say that because actually I've been adding up how much it actually sums up to. And literally, it is huge. If you figure the world legal economy is somewhere between $33 and $37 trillion, you're figuring maybe 1/30th of that is going into war products. And another, if you just double that, is going into all the supplies behind war, the uniforms, the penicillin, all the things you need to keep an army and a population alive at war. But one of the big wild cards here is a lot of this goes on illegally.
Mm-hmm.
Huge amounts of this is not charted, and therefore it's a lot of money and a lot of power we don't control legally.
Well, if you think about it, too, I just had this thought, is that it's part of, in a sense, discretionary spending. In other words, you took the world economy, what's necessary for one to survive, and you have to spend that. But then the rest of it, what can you buy then? I mean, well, we want to buy, I don't know, one of these little things that go beep, you know, these little computers and stuff like that. But also, in a, I think if you put... war material in there and just had this whole large discretionary spending area would probably even amount to a significantly larger chunk of the world economy.
Ooh, you are good at this, you know. That's actually something that's very hard for me to get across. But I actually went onto the front lines and began to go with the truckers and the pilots and the black marketeers that carry this stuff in and out of war zones. I went to the ports and talked to the shippers and the black marketeers and all of these people that make this possible. And you are spot on correct, because what do you need in a war zone? You don't just need a weapon. You need communication systems. Well, that means computers. That means software. That means a ton of stuff that average industries are churning out all over the world. So, yes. Sony and Mercedes-Benz and all the software companies and Windows are also making a fortune because you have to have this stuff at war zones.
Mm-hmm.
And no local industries are working because they're all bombed out. So they have to buy it from Shanghai and Singapore and San Francisco.
Carolyn Nordstrom is my guest on the Peter Werby Show. Her book is Shadows of War, and the shadows, this is what we're talking about. We're talking about the shadows. We see the war and the result of it every night on the television. Let's just get just back a little. You started to fascinate me a bit about your personal history. Chris Hedges, whose book, the name always escapes me, about war. Do you remember these New York? Do you remember the name of it? By?
Sorry.
Okay, well, it's my job. I'm supposed to.
Thank you. Got me off the hook.
Yeah. Anyways, book about being a war correspondent and also war photographers. Mm-hmm. Ultimately, they say they like being there. They like the juice. And would Carolyn Nordstrom be happy if you were just examining, we said arrowheads before, but kind of very interesting Inuit cultures up in Alaska or wherever? Or is this, at some level, is this enjoyable, or is that the word we would use for it?
Yeah, I'm glad you asked that, because I get this a lot, that somehow there's a real rush to war, and in some ways that's really dangerous, because people who haven't been in war zones then translate that into, well, people in war zones can't have it that bad if there's something fun, something juicy about it. I was really lucky, because I walked into war zones without planning to study them. I walked into a place that was supposed to be paradise, it was Sri Lanka, to study medicine. But I walked in having worked in emergency rooms, in medicine.
Mm-hmm.
And a doctor walks into an emergency room to make things better. They don't walk in and say, oh, man, there's this high rush, or, oh, God, I'm getting this cheap adrenaline thrill. They walk in and say, I can make a difference in the world. And, I'm really lucky, because I took that right into war with me. So I really don't have that juice thing that so many people talk about. And that's good, because I've done this now for 20 years, and I haven't burned out. Because I walk in and I see mom, dad, and the kids, and their little kid just stepped on a landmine, or dad just got blown up, or mom just got raped and tortured, and there isn't any juice to that. That's just really sad. It's like watching someone die from cancer, or watching someone die from getting hit in a car accident. And what you do is just try to make the world a little bit better. So, well, I think I'm lucky.
Well, on the other hand, you must have, well, whenever people do something that the rest of us think is brave, I've never heard anybody say, yes, it was very brave on my part, or it did take a lot of courage. But when I read through Shadows of War, and I see you talking about jumping on these supply planes and being in Mozambique and all that, and if you called me and said, hey, Pete, we're off to, I'd say, write me. I mean, there's no way, and I'm very serious, there's no way in the world would I think to go to some of these places and go through the conveyances, like a supply plane. Maybe just give us an example from the book. I remember you were talking in the book about going on some of these supply planes. I think it was in Mozambique, wasn't it?
Yes, it was. What? I actually have done that in many countries, because it's a wonderful way to travel.
Well, but it must have some peril attached to it as well.
I think the thing is, you're right, we don't tend to think of ourselves as doing anything courageous, because The first thing you discover is that there's a remarkable community in a war zone. These pilots, honest to God, they're amazing. I would love to do a book on them alone. These are crusty old war horses who get out into planes that are completely rattle-trapped, held together with bubble gum and duct tape, and they fly 7 runs a day, overloaded dangerously, to take food out to people who've just been bombed out. And so, you know, when I jump on a plane and they give me a ride and I go out there to interview these people, I think more about these pilots than I do about myself, because they're doing this day in and day out for years.
Hmm.
They're making, now a lot of these guys are nuts, but they're wonderfully nuts, and they are making such a difference, and no CNN crew, you know, no sort of New York Times ever gets out there to document these guys. I mean, they're really amazing. So we tend to think of them as being sort of the, you know, a lot of the NGOs are out there, Save the Children, CARE. I mean, working on the front lines, digging up landmines, you know, taking care of little babies who just got a leg blown off. And nobody ever, you know, gives them the time. They make it like $5 a day. So there's some real heroes out there. You don't ever feel like you're doing too much, because there's so many cool people out there making a difference.
Well, it does. I mean, actually, given my beliefs about peace and social justice, it in a sense, it does make me a little ashamed. That is that I, you know, those people are really walking the walk, whereas, like I say, if someone said, here, you can actually be one of those people that, you know, that that are trying to make a difference, that are trying to stop landmines, that are any number of things out there where I've interviewed so many people, I wouldn't go. So there must be some component there that they have that I don't.
Well, you do, actually, and I've got a quick story for you that'll make you feel good. There's a wonderful movie about two women, but it's a theme that comes up over and over again. Two best friends who go to war, and one chooses to become a commander on the front lines, and the other chooses to become a journalist. And what the whole movie is about is that each one is critical, because if you don't get information out to people, if you don't tell the truth, the world doesn't change. So what you're doing is actually an incredibly important part of the whole process.
Folks, that's why I invited Carolyn Nordstrom on. Now, actually, we're talking about her incredible book, Shadows of War, Violence, Power, and International Profiteering in the 21st Century. And tell us a little more about the shadows. The shadows mean is what we don't see.
Mm-hmm,
we talked a little about the economic aspects of it. Mm-hmm. What else is in the shadows?
There's a lot that takes place in the shadows, and the economics is really big, because without a weapon, you don't have a war. But there's a lot that people never talk about. For example, 90% of all casualties today are civilians. The majority of these are women and children. In the world today, more children are tortured than adult soldiers. Now, these are things that no army wants to admit. It goes on worldwide. It's not one country worse than the other. It's a pattern that's taking place sort of globally today. But it's a pattern that won't change until people begin to become outraged. But they can't become outraged. And this, again, goes back to the whole point of journalism. They can't become outraged until people know what's really going on. Well, what military is going to admit they just bombed out a whole city or tortured a 12-year-old boy or girl to get information? So the shadows covers a whole lot of atrocities and war realities that people just don't want known.
Well, tell us about some of what fuels this world economy of war as well. You mentioned diamonds in a couple of different contexts.
Mm-hmm. I started out actually with diamonds, because I realized that whatever war zone I went to on whatever continent, I was seeing the same arms merchants and profiteering taking place. I mean, they'd be selling in one country, they'd be selling in the next country, and I was seeing the same group of people moving around the world. So I began to sort of chart what was going on, and okay, what war zone has a currency people want to use on an international market? Almost none, because the currencies collapse. So to get weapons, to get penicillin, to get food, to get whatever it is you need, communication systems, people have to sell something that people want on the international markets. Well, blood diamonds are great. Diamonds are easy to transport. They're wonderful to, you know, move right into an international economy. So those buy weapons really easily. So is gold. So do minerals, zinc, coltan. It's really interesting, though. Timber, seafood, human labor.
Really?
Kids working in agriculture. It's a huge industry in 12 to 14-year-old boys and girls who will go into another country and work in agricultural fields, make carpets, sex industry, sadly enough. So anything that will get you money on the international market to buy what you need is fuel in the war economy. And a lot of this, of course, again, just like human rights violations, people don't want known.
Mm-hmm. Tell us, though, specifically about the phrase blood diamonds. I'm not sure everyone is familiar with that.
Blood diamonds, it started in some of the wars in Africa, which took place in really great, rich diamond mined areas. And what would happen is that the war would literally take place around the diamond mines, each side fighting to control the diamond mines. Because you could have, I mean, they figure a country like Angola, which had a war end in 2001, but during the decades before that, they figured $1 million a day in diamonds alone were leaving the country illegally. $1 million a day.
Now, could those wind up in this country, or do they?
They wind up on your girlfriend's engagement ring.
Now, actually, one of the reasons I asked that is neighbors of ours are getting married, and both of them did not want blood diamonds, and so they were trying to get diamonds that were certified from Canada. Is there a way to actually know the origins of the diamonds you're buying?
The truth is I've literally gone to these certification seminars in war zones. Okay, the official line is, yes, you can certify. But if you do the work I do, which is you talk to the smugglers, you talk to the forgers, the truth is no, because any smuggler and forger worth their weight in gold or diamonds can whip out those certifications in 5 seconds. So the truth is these diamonds are shot throughout the legal economy. Much of the certification is completely illegal.
No, it's depressing, very depressing. Carolyn Nordstrom is my guest. She's the author of Shadows of War. It's published by the University of California Press. We talked earlier about all the different, or are there all the different countries you've been in? What are the countries you've been in where there has been war and that you've been looking at for your now fourth book on war?
Well, I started out in Southern Asia, Sri Lanka, India, Southeast Asia. Then I moved over to do some comparison in Southern Africa, spent time in the Balkans, traveled a bit through South America. I've actually, 20 years on the road, you cover a lot of countries.
Yeah, and you said that it doesn't bring juice, or that it doesn't have that kind of adrenaline that sometimes you get some people saying that the life in those war zones provide. But how about the opposite effects? I mean, when I was just at a film festival last night, and they had photographs of children in Iraq that were just injured so badly, and I spent most of the time looking at the ground. I couldn't even take looking at the photographs. And you've seen, I assume, numerous dead people, dead children, dead
Absolutely.
Soldiers.
Oh yeah.
Doesn't that kind of weigh on the psyche after a while?
That's one question I'm really glad you asked, because there's one thing that's really important for me to get across when I talk about what I've found on the front lines, and this is the most surprising thing. Most of us in the Western world have kind of grown up on a sort of a public, it's just general public viewpoint that it's kind of a dog-eat-dog world out there, that in the violence of the front lines, people become animals, and they'll just rape and kill and plunder because there's no control. The amazing thing is I have found this is completely wrong. I have found that on the front lines, the vast majority of people become incredibly good.
Really?
Now, I have documented this. I have thousands of examples. Most people on the front lines set up trade routes to places that have been bombed out, set up midnight hospitals in the middle of fields when people are bombing the regular hospitals to try to destroy morale. People are setting up clean water systems. They're taking care of one another. They're setting up schools under trees when the schools have been bombed out. Most people become astoundingly good. They really try to regenerate their communities and set up healing systems for broken bodies and broken communities and broken everything in the most amazingly sort of valuable and value-full ways. So, yeah, I've seen a lot of really horrible things, but what gives me balance is I've actually seen more good than the average person ever does in their life.
Well, yeah.
That gives me such hope.
I guess in such intense situations that rather if we don't have to decide either, paper or plastic or which channel to turn, when those decisions really are about life and death. And I often wonder when I read about war zones and the chances that people take, and like I was saying earlier, I was thinking, man, I don't know what I would do. I think that when you're really faced with it, that most people do rise to the occasion.
They do.
Yeah.
And beautifully. I mean, with astounding creativity. I mean, people really come up with beautiful solutions. solutions to really difficult situations.
You talk in your book about Shadows of War about ethnographies, which is a rather academic term, but ethnography. Ethnography. Don't laugh at me.
I'm laughing with you.
You're my guest. I can't say it now.
Ethnographies.
Ethnographies of war. Those are what? Those are essentially, just as you said, looking at people and how cultures and subcultures are created in that context?
Anthropologists who study culture. There's two kinds of anthropologists. Those who study the dead, you know, like Indiana Jones,
mm-hmm.
and those who study the living, like Margaret Mead. So those of us who study the living, we do, you're right, it's just a jargony term. We call it ethnography. But all it means is going out into a community and figuring out how people live their lives. What do they value? What do they think about? What do they do during their day? So I just go out onto the front lines and do that.
Well, how about in areas like the Balkans or in Angola? I mean, talk about totally reconfiguring life as people once knew it. Mm-hmm. This war situation has completely altered life for so many different peoples around the world. And sometimes maybe internally, you know, good, like we love all Serbs, but we hate all, you know, everybody mm-hmm. else outside. There must be a mix as well.
You know, it's interesting because one of the things I've been finding out is that I've been really literally redefining the very definition of violence. Because we've tended in our societies to think of violence as harm to the physical body. But one of the things I'm finding out is that you can actually harm a society. You know, if you kill enough people, if you do enough damage in terms of torture or indiscriminate bombing or the killing of children, you know, you shock people. You really mess them up. Soldiers who kill are truly messed up. I mean, they figure that a good 95% of soldiers are really emotionally damaged by just being in war. As much as they're soldiers and in many places they're heroes, in some places they're dogs, depending on your point of view, it doesn't matter. They're still damaged. And, of course, and see, this is where this whole point of the good comes in, because people literally have to not only put back together damaged bodies, they have to rebuild damaged societies. So, you know, a society coming out of war, and we see this in Iraq, of course, has to answer not only how do you remake a community? How do you rebuild an educational system? How do you rebuild a justice system? You know, how do you get your media back up and running and honest? What's democracy and how do you make it work? You know, so these are critical things going on as a war sort of tries to solve itself.
Yeah, and you're hopeful about all of that. That's good. That's good. I have not been very hopeful about much lately, and the damage that's been inflicted on so many traditional societies by the seemingly endless war often doesn't give me much room for hope. But since you're closer to it, you've been in these areas, I'd like to hear that.
I am hopeful. If you look at as an anthropologist, I have a view of history that's several million years long. And we go through cycles of war where mostly young men go out and kill each other in trenches, like the First World War, to really dangerous eras like we're in today, where mostly civilians get killed because the war is taking place in city centers. This is why I think journalism is so important, because people pretty much are outraged when you start killing average families. But you got to get the idea out there that war is changing today, and we've got to do something about it, or we will destroy the fabric of our world.
Hmm.
So I'm hopeful that people care. It's just getting them the information so they can do something about it.
Well, this is what Richard Goldstone, former chief prosecutor of the International War Crimes Tribunal for Rwanda and the former Yugoslavia, has to say about your book. This is a gripping account of what the author calls research into the shadows, the often dangerous world of the powerful and wealthy who inhabit global extra-governmental organizations. It is also about the dehumanizing effects of war and violence on the victims. This book provides a rare opportunity of, quote, being there with a courageous and highly observant anthropologist. And he says, I highly recommend it. Thank you so much, Carolyn Nordstrom, for being with me. The book, again, Shadows of War, Violence, Power, and International Profiteering in the 21st Century. And I will have this up on my website. Right now, it's just ucpress.edu. Carolyn, is there a direct web address for this? Or I'll find it and put it up there for you.
That would be lovely, because I'm actually not at a computer right now. I really don't know.
Thank you so much for joining me.
And thank you for asking me. I appreciate it.
This is WRIF.com.
expensive. There's more people and more percentage of our population that are uninsured than any industrial country in the world. And we've done lots of shows on these topics, and also the astronomical profits of the drug companies, how their millions and billions allow them to influence politics. But I want to bring a man, an author, to our microphones who has a different perspective on all of this. The book is called On the Take: How Medicine's Complicity with Big Business Can Endanger Your Health. And the author is Jerome P. Kasurer. He is a distinguished professor at Tufts University School of Medicine, an adjunct professor of medicine at Yale University School of Medicine. And he's been the editor-in-chief of the New England Journal of Medicine for more than 8 years. Dr. Kasurer, thanks for joining me.
Pleasure to be with you, Peter.
You're no longer the editor, though, right, of the New England?
Correct. I was from 1991 to 1999.
This book of yours, which essentially talks about, on the take, I mean, right away, talks about corruption, the corruption of the medical profession by money. This couldn't make you too popular.
Yeah, I didn't write it to be popular, I'm afraid. What I've done is really kind of documented what I believe is an ethically challenged profession. I would be first to say that it's not everybody that's ethically challenged. It's perhaps a fraction of the profession, but it's serious and problematic.
Yeah, so, well, describe just the nature of this. I mean, it's quite widespread that you document in your book On the Take, and it has different aspects. But how is medicine's complicity with big business endangering our health?
Well, the complexity of the relationships between physicians and industry is a start at looking at it. The first point is that doctors are given gifts, they're given lunches and dinners, and their education is being paid by industry. They are engaged with industry as consultants, and they are involved with industry and as lecturers for the companies. They hold patents on certain drugs, and all of these financial relationships can lead to two important consequences, or perhaps more than two, but two important consequences. One is that it can harm individual patients. It can harm classes of patients. It can also information that doctors get from various sources, journals and lectures and so forth. And finally, it can raise the cost of medical care because of the fact that the advertising generally leads to the use of the newest and most expensive drugs.
Hmm. Now, maybe we should flesh some of this out, because
sure,
on the face of it, the description doesn't speak of corruption directly. In fact, we're told that very frequently that doctors are confronted with so many medical choices in terms of what pharmaceuticals that they can prescribe, is that if it wasn't for the salespeople, if it wasn't for the pitches, that they couldn't even keep track of it. So that the relationship isn't inherently corrupt, or is it?
Well, of course, you know, we have 87,000 drug salesmen out there every year trying to promote their own products, and there's pretty good evidence that the information that they give doctors is not always completely and totally objective. And it's also true that the information that people get from lectures that are sponsored by drug companies are not always objective. And what I'd like to see is doctors get their information from places and publications that are not tainted by drug money.
Mm-hmm. Now, you are or have been a practicing physician, correct?
Yes, yes.
Yeah, and so how did, in your own practice, how did this come about, and what did you face, and what were your decisions? To give us an example.
Well, I think I described in the book one example that was really quite eye-opening to me. When I was a young physician, just starting out in practice, I
published a paper about certain kinds of drugs, diuretic drugs, and suddenly I was latched onto by one of the big pharmaceutical companies and asked to become a speaker for them, which I did. And it was very seductive because I was making $700 for every lecture I gave, and they would fly me around the country, and they never asked me to say anything about their drug. So I went along and was doing fine, and then finally they asked me to come to Madison Avenue and learn how to do TV slots. I did that, and then at the very end they said, well, you're all ready to do videos for us now, and all you have to do is mention the name of our drug once. And I said, wait a minute, I don't do that. That was the end of my involvement with that company. They didn't call me much after that. So these relationships are insidious. When you're giving a lecture for a drug company, if you're not sympathetic to their cause, which is their marketing cause, they may not ask you again. And that's the kind of seduction. $700 then was probably worth $2,000 now. So, and there are plenty of doctors that are out there giving lectures for drug companies at that kind of rate, and there is a relationship between the money you get and some kind of obligation for reciprocity.
Mm-hmm. Well, Dr. Kassirer, how would you have been compromised if you simply would have said, yes, take brand X or brand X diuretic is actually a wonderful product? How would that have compromised you?
It might have compromised me to say more positive about the drug than was appropriate. It might have also compromised me by forgetting or neglecting to talk about the risks of certain drugs. And we've had lots of examples in the recent past of instances where the validity of information that came out to the public was questioned because of these relationships. For example, a couple of weeks ago, there was a lot of publicity about the lack of publishing negative studies. There was another example of the cholesterol guidelines, and another example, most recently, of Vioxx.
Mm-hmm.
And in every one of those instances, there's a question of whether, in some way, the medical information was influenced by a conflict of interest.
Sure. Well, tell us, because some of these recommendations are interesting, because then, as you show in your book On the Take, some of these people wind up to be on the board of the organization that they're endorsing.
Yeah. Well, one very specific example that I give in the book is a drug called Resulin, which was introduced for the treatment of diabetes, and it was kind of a new drug, and it was a really exciting drug. It was introduced at the National Institutes of Health. And it turned out that the person who was running the study had patents on the drug. It turned out after a period of time that there was toxicity of the drug. There's liver damage occurred as a consequence of the drug. It came before the FDA several times. In the meantime, the British equivalent of the FDA took it off the market, but it remained on the market in the United States. And later on, there had been some 30-some deaths. It was reviewed again by the FDA and continued on the market. Finally, one of the review groups that looked at the toxicity of the drugs, it turned out that almost all of the people on the review committee had an arrangement with Warner Lambert, the company that made the drug. They kept it on the market. Finally, in the year 2000, it was removed from the market after 60 people died or so. And there's a lot of litigation about that now in the courts. So now, do we know that those people, the majority of people on that committee who were involved with Warner Lambert in some consulting arrangement, do we know if their opinion was influenced by their financial connection? We don't. But it's worrisome. And what we'd like to have involved in those decisions are people who do not have financial arrangements.
You would think so. Jerome P. Kasura is my guest. He's a professor of medicine, also a doctor himself. He's written a book for Oxford University Press, On the Take, How Medicine's Complicity with Big Business Can Endanger Your Health. Now, you were the editor for 8 years in the 90s of the prestigious New England Journal of Medicine, something that has that cachet of absolute trust and confidence, and it sounds like that's what you tried to maintain during your stint there. But you allowed physicians to write certain kinds of articles only if they were free from any financial involvement. Did that prove to be difficult at all? And when people were confronted with that, other doctors or researchers, what was their reaction?
Well, Peter, there basically are two kinds of articles that we focused on. One was scientific articles, where the investigator gives you all the information, all the data. And in those articles, it really doesn't matter whether somebody has a financial conflict of interest because they've given you the data. Of course, unless they're lying, and you know, in general, that doesn't happen. But there are articles where, such as review articles where you review a condition or review a drug, or opinion pieces like editorials where the author really picks and chooses from the literature the kinds of information he uses. And in those circumstances, what you want to do, at least what we wanted to do, was to have people write those who did not have financial arrangements with industry. And it became increasingly difficult over the years that I was there to find people who didn't have a financial conflict. And that's one of the things that alerted me to the fact that this was becoming more problematic.
What were the reaction, though? I mean, was it, what's the matter with this Kasura guy? Is he, is he being a little too hard line on this? I mean, did you get that kind of reaction?
Well, yes. It turned out the policy of not allowing people to write review articles and editorials if they had a financial conflict is one that my predecessor, Arnold Relman, had instituted. I just continued it. But when we turned people down for writing such articles, they were sometimes furious with us. Now, it turned out that my predecessor, Jeff Drazen, at the Journal, felt that it was just too impossible to get people, and he loosened up the policy, now allows some people to write these articles if they have conflicts, and simply discloses their the conflict. And that is not an ideal approach, but I can understand why he did it.
This is sort of a broader question. I just had this thought while we were discussing this specific issue. 50 years ago, most of the major institutions of this society were well respected, including a lot of its operatives, Congress, politicians in general, the police, medicine. The list is endless. And now we're almost getting this picture of corruption at every at every point, other than like firemen. It turns out that firemen now are the most respected people in the country. Is there any thought of, or do you treat in your book On the Take what it does overall to the to this prestige that medicine should enjoy?
Well, you're absolutely right about the decline in prestige. We've even seen in recent years the decline in prestige of major news organizations, including.
Oh, I forgot about that. Yes,
newspaper and television. You know, most recently.
And radio. That was. I should have done full disclosure here.
Well, poor Dan Rather having gotten stuck in a big mistake. The fact is that if you look at the newspapers from day to day, it is unbelievable how often you come across conflicts of interest in just about every walk of life. And part of it is, I have to say, is generated by the fact that we allow our major legislators to be bought by special interest groups. The lobbying that goes on and the kind of influence that is exacted by money is absolutely astonishing. It's not only, by the way, politicians. It's in many different circumstances. But as you read the papers from day to day, you find that there's an enormous amount of conflict of interest, financial conflict of interest. And I think that if you look at how this all developed in medicine, I'm quite convinced that part of it is just a reflection of what goes on in society.
Mm-hmm. You know, it is possible, I'm sure you would agree, that that this can be supervised, because I was thinking about the broadcast industry that I take part in. Every year I have to sign an affidavit that I have not taken any payola, that I have not taken any money to play any records, or I suppose nobody's given me any money to interview any authors or anything like that. And this is regulated by the Federal Communications Commission because of the scandal. What was it now? 25, 30 years ago? Something like that, when payola and plugola were the big deal. And I mean, I can't even let a record company take me out to lunch.
Aha, now you've come to what I think is the critical point. And that is that doctors shouldn't be in the same circumstance. Why should, just think about this, why should journalists, radio people like yourself, why should they have a higher standard than doctors? I mean, it is ridiculous. Doctors should have the highest standard because they deal with human life. And they deal with the private secrets of people. I mean, that seems to me to be an overwhelming difference between what doctors do and what firemen do. I mean, firemen, at least, they risk their lives. But doctors have this special relationship. They're supposed to supposed to put the patient first, not their pocketbooks first.
Well, there should be, of course, and we can maybe come to that at the end of our discussion, which is coming up in just a few minutes, about what kind of remedial steps can be taken. But on the individual level, more and more is being put off, and maybe for the good, on the patient, because
right.
It used to be just whatever doctor said, you would just pop in your mouth, whereas now we all have these physicians' desk references of our own. They're little drug books. We look up, and what's the, you know, is there any one, what are the side effects and what have you. And for instance, my wife needed an anti-inflammatory that did not upset her stomach recently, and she was prescribed Bextra.
Mm-hmm.
But she could have just as easily had Vioxx prescribed for her, right?
Sure.
How does one know what one's physician is basing their prescriptions on?
Well, first of all, it's my view that what you're doing in taking responsibility for your own medical care is what you should be doing. You wouldn't buy an appliance if you didn't know something about it. You wouldn't buy certain kinds of other consumer goods without knowing a lot about it. And I think you have to look at medicine exactly the same way. You have to know a lot more about medicine than you really want to. But aside from that, I think there's some guidelines that people can follow with respect to their association with their doctors. Certainly, if a doctor wants you to be involved in a clinical trial that you're not so sure about, you should ask another doctor. If your doctor is recommending expensive tests, too many x-rays of some kind, too many an additional cardiac catheterization or some other expensive procedure, you need to get another opinion about that. And I think that in some circumstances it wouldn't be inappropriate to ask the doctor how he is reimbursed for his services.
Also, it depends frequently on your doctor and partly how you're situated. I mean, someone like myself, I'm quite demanding of my doctor, and he seems to be okay with it. But some doctors don't like being questioned.
Yeah, and then find another doctor.
Yeah, it's probably that simple, right? If someone is let's go back to I was thinking of something you said earlier when we first began discussing your book On the Take. And that is, you said a small percentage of doctors are involved in this. Is there any way to statistically put any figures on this? Is how many doctors really are complicit with big business and are endangering our health?
Well, all we have is spotty information from lectures that doctors give where they're required to disclose their conflicts, and from medical journals. We have some surveys that were done by my colleagues at Harvard and at Yale, in which it turns out of the academic group, about a quarter of them are have major involvements with industry. We also have the statement from the Washington Legal Foundation, which is a legal group that defends the drug industry, and their statement, I think, was really astonishing. They said, I have a quote right here, they say, how does it go here?
You look for it. I'll reintroduce the book, On the Take, How Medicine's Complicity with Big Business Can Endanger Your Health. On the Peter Werbe Show, my guest is Jerome P. Kasirer, and it's published by Oxford Press. I'll have that link to it on my website as well.
I also have a website, by
the way. Oh, yeah, that's right.
It's onthetake.net.
Okay, I'll put that one on.
But here's the quote. They say, it's widely acknowledged that most of the top medical authorities in this country and virtually all of the top speakers on medical topics are employed in some capacity by one or more of the country's pharmaceutical companies.
So they don't make any secret about it, because you have a chapter in your book called Influenced by Gifts, Not I.
Right.
So
right.
There's not a, I'm certainly no one's going to say, wow, this is corrupting medicine, this is influencing, overly influencing, or my attempt is not to over-influence other doctors to prescribe this. But there must be actually a drive to get in on this money.
Yes, and that's the sad part of it. Especially, you have young investigators, young researchers, who are getting their money from drug companies, and in some way, this forces them to do the kind of work that they would prefer not to do, but they can kind of have to do that because their projects are forced in that direction. I had one particular example where a young person had joined the faculty of a medical school and was expecting to do her own work, and it turned out that she was required to do some of the work of the pharmaceutical company that supported her position.
Well, that, you know, what's the old phrase? He who pays the piper calls the tune. Your last chapter in On the Take is What Can Be Done. I mentioned in our industry, the Federal Communications Commission. Is there any way, or what avenue should we be looking at to stop these practices?
Well, I would like to give the profession one last chance. It's quite clear to me that it's not moving on these issues, and I think it needs to move on the issues, and certainly things can be done. For example, committees that make a clinical policy, I think, should not have people on them who are conflicted. I think that major medical organizations, such as the American Heart Association, the American Medical Association, should not be led by people who have conflicts of interest with industry. And I think that doctors should stop taking meals and trinkets and pens and cups and whatever it is from drug companies. I think that needs to stop. If that doesn't happen, then I think sooner or later the government is going to step in.
Well, Dr. Jordan J. Cohen agrees with you. He's the president of the Association of American Medical Colleges, and he says public outrage at the unconscionable practices documented in this book may be our only hope of redirecting the medical profession away from overweening self-interest and back towards its moral purpose, protecting patients' interests. My guest on the Peter Werbe Show, Jerome P. Kasirer, he's the author of On the Take, How Medicine's Complicity with Big Business Can Endanger Your Health. You can go on to On the Take. Take.net. That'll be on my website as well, peterwerbe.com. Dr. Kasirer, thanks for spending the time with us.
It's a pleasure to be with you, Peter, anytime.
And now, a word from the Riff Legal Eagles. Unless otherwise stated, all entrants for WRIF contests must be at least 18 years of age and a legal resident of the United States. A household is eligible to win one contest per 30 days every 6 months for prizes valued at $600 or higher. Greater Media Detroit and its affiliates, promotional sponsors, advertising and promotional agencies, and other radio and television stations in the Detroit ADI are not eligible to participate. One entry per person. No purchase or other consideration is necessary to participate in the contest. Void where prohibited. Prizes are not transferable or redeemable for cash. 101 WRIF reserves the right to substitute any prize for one of equal or greater value. By participating in the contest, contestants consent to the broadcast and or publication of their name, voice, face, and or likeness without compensation. Participants listening online at www.wrif.com may receive audio that is delayed by as much as 60 seconds later than the over-the-air transmission, which could potentially affect chances of winning. General contest rules are available online at www.wrif.com or during regular business hours at the WRIF Studios, 1 Radio Plaza, Detroit, Michigan, 48220. You're listening to WRIF.com.
Day of 2006 is coming this Tuesday, and every 101 minutes, the Riff will be making someone a big winner. Keep listening for details from 101 WRIF. Everything that rocks.